I was working for Walmart and I was missing raw each week. And I was like, oh my gosh, I can't do this. Should I quit my job? Yeah. I was considering quitting the job, but I didn't have to. There was Hulu. Now I can watch Monday Night Raw, SmackDown, all of it, whenever I want. If you submit! I want people to know how much I love WWE. It is everything to me. It's what I live. It's what I breathe. Don't get it twisted. I'm not a wrestling fan. I'm a WWE fan, absolutely.
Douche chill.
It's business time, baby.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
My client, Brock Lesnar, conquered the street.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
You fat. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
Welcome to episode 378 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off here for Sunday, April 12th. 2015. I am the Solemn Monster. That is a real advertisement that you heard there at the beginning. That is an actual WWE ad for Hulu. Completely legit. But sometimes the best comedy is kind of just there to speak for itself, and you really don't have to do much to it. I just find it funny. You know, it's one thing to see somebody say, "Well, I'm a WWE fan. I'm not a wrestling fan. That wrestling's a dirty word. I don't like wrestling, I like WWE. It's a completely different thing, though, to say that you would consider quitting your job at Walmart so that you can watch Monday Night Raw. I don't know anybody in their right frame of mind who would actually admit to something like that. Like, yeah, totally, yeah, I quit my job at Walmart, yeah. Like, really, Monday Night Raw, really, yeah, yeah. Anyway, you can stream this podcast in the brand new Podbean app. For iPhone, go to the App Store right now. It is free. You can download the official Podbean app and stream episodes of the Solemn Monster Sounds Off each and every week. They do have an Android app coming soon, although we have our own standalone Android app, free, in the Google Play Store, called Solemn Monster Sounds Off. Go there right now. You can download it, stream all the episodes. It's pretty cool. And of course, you can also subscribe in iTunes, Stitcher Radio, Audio Boom, TuneIn Radio, lots of different ways to listen to this podcast, so please keep spreading the word. Thank you to everybody who has been spreading our Audible link, audibletrial.com/solemonster. We've gotten a bunch of signups over the last week or so. We need more, though. We need more signups. It doesn't cost you a thing. You just punch in that URL, you sign up for a free trial of the service, you can sample it for 30 days. And as long as you cancel in those 30 days, if you're not happy with it, you won't be billed, and you get to keep your free audiobook. That's right, you get to cash in one free audiobook, doesn't matter how long it is, what it's about. It could be a wrestling book, a non-wrestling book. It's pretty cool stuff. A lot of you guys seem to enjoy it. I know some of you have stuck with the service long-term, which is very cool. I've converted some long-time customers, but you don't have to be. But all you got to do is punch in that URL, get your free book, and you're helping this podcast out by doing that. So audibletrial.com/solemonster. And if you like what you hear each week, please consider making a PayPal donation on thesolemonster.com. You'll see the PayPal box on the right-hand side. You can give whatever you want, whenever you want. It's like a store that's open 24 hours a day. You can pop on over there. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname and a shout-out. $30 or more will get you not only the nickname and the shout-out, but a brief shout-out for the name and URL of your own wrestling podcast, if you have one. Just make sure you provide that information to me when you submit your donation. I think we have a competition going on here to see who can get their name mentioned the most times on the air. Got a lot of repeat donations this week, which is very cool to see. We have Russell the Muscle, Yvonne Bruiser Balak, Sean Nasty Boy Nilsson, Hytham the Equalizer Al Nawasser, Ladies Man Levi Daly, Tori All I Do Is Win Johansson, the Australian Ass Kicker, Anthony Patty, still one of the better names that I've doled out. Out of Control, Cody Thomas. Malicious Intent, Michael Cuomo. True Grit, Tim Goggin. Mop the Floor, Joe Hoare. Rowdy, Rafayette Hossein. The Master of Mischief, Matthew Atkins. Moneymaker, Malik Hollingsworth. Shooting Star, Stephen Jones. Brian Kerosene Kinnerson. And the Dark Serpent, Derek Gibbs. Thank you very much, by the way, to Derek for the very generous donation. But thank you to everybody who donated. You're under no obligation to do so, but it is the best and most direct way to keep supporting this podcast if you love it. Go to thesolemonster.com and you can make a donation on the right-hand side of the page. And finally here, our store on Pro Wrestling Tees continues to thrive and do well thanks to you guys. ProWrestlingTees.com/Solemonster Sounds Off. Nearly 20 different designs up in the store and counting. We have up to a size 5XL on all of our shirts, for those of you who have inquired. Plus, they ship all over the world, and you can pay via PayPal, via credit card, whatever is most convenient for you. So head on over to ProWrestlingTees.com/Solemonster Sounds Off and get your Sound Off shirt right now. Tough Enough is coming back Tuesday, June 23rd at 8 p.m. Eastern. Mark it down. That is the return of Tough Enough, debuting on the USA Network with what WWE is calling a reimagined format with new live elements. What a corporate bullshit word that is. I hate that word. Reimagined. They do that with movies. They'll take a movie that was great, and then instead of coming up with an original idea, because Hollywood is completely devoid of original ideas these days, they'll say, oh, it's not a remake. No, we're reimagining the film. So now they're reimagining Tough Enough. You're changing the format. Why can't you just say that? We are changing the format for Tough Enough. We are improving the format. No. We are reimagining the format. They also announced that SmackDown is moving to the USA Network in early 2016. No word on if it will remain on Thursdays. Here's an interesting quote, though. There was a Variety interview with the president of the USA Network, this guy Chris McCumber. And I really haven't seen any of the big news sites pick up on this, so maybe it means nothing, but I certainly paid attention to what he said here. He said, WWE is such an iconic American brand, it feels thematically right to have their two biggest properties on USA Network. Having more live programming is a good thing for this network. Having SmackDown and doubling down on WWE is important to us. The key word there is live. I've not heard anybody else mention that SmackDown is definitely going live or even speculating on whether or not it's going to go live. I haven't seen any of the big websites talking about it, but I sure noticed that when the guy said that. So I think there's a very real possibility that not only is SmackDown going to move to a better network, which absolutely USA is a better network. Now, here's the thing. I mean, you have Sci-Fi Channel, I believe, has availability in about 94 million homes, give or take, and USA Network's in about 98. So they're in roughly the same number of homes. It's not like USA is in 100 million homes and Sci-Fi's only in 50. They're pretty close to one another, but I don't know anybody who would argue that Sci-Fi is a more visible network than USA. USA is consistently ranked number one. If it's not number one, it's in the top three. It's usually fighting it out with, you know, ESPN and networks like that. Sci-Fi is never even near the top of the list. So strictly for visibility, if nothing else, USA, it's a much bigger network for SmackDown to be on. But it's very possible, I think, that SmackDown could end up live on Tuesdays next year. If they move from Thursdays, it could be a Tuesday night thing. I don't see them going live on a Thursday just because schedule-wise, I don't think that would work. You know, you can't have everybody on the road for Raw Monday. I mean, what are you going to do? You're going to send people home for a day and a half? Fly them out for a live show Thursday? I mean, it just doesn't make sense. So if it went live, it would have to be on Tuesdays. And it wouldn't conflict with Tough Enough, because Tough Enough is debuting in June. I mean, by January of next year, believe me, Tough Enough will not be on the air. You know, it's not going to be one long season of Tough Enough. So I think that was the biggest takeaway that I took from this, is that SmackDown potentially could be going live. But whether it does or not, it's definitely a good move for WWE. They'll be on a better network. I don't know that that's going to mean SmackDown all of a sudden is going to be an important show, because right now it isn't, but we'll see. The other thing I want to mention before we get into Raw, and this is more just something I wanted to shine a light on here, just because I think it's appropriate to do. There were a lot of stories about Steve Austin potentially being on the outs with WWE, having heat with WWE. On his podcast, Steve Austin addressed the rumors of there being heat, claimed they were blown out of proportion, and there is no heat, at least on his end, with WWE. And that may well be true. Okay, Austin himself may have absolutely no heat and no ill will toward WWE at all, and they may work together again 6 months down the road. But I trust the guys over at PW Insider, and they were one of the websites that you know, reported some of this news about Austin that I think he was trying to refute on his podcast. You know, PW Insider is a website. They have reliable sources, and they're sticking to their story. They're not retracting it. They're not apologizing for it. They're sticking to their story. And I just feel compelled to defend them because I see on our Facebook group, and I see on other on Reddit and other message boards and other places, you know, people who just blindly assume that, well, Austin said everything is A-OK on his podcast, so it's just typical dirt sheet BS. It's not typical dirt sheet BS. Okay, just stop the nonsense. What they said is that Austin was booked on the same flight as The Undertaker. There was some kind of connecting flight, maybe in Dallas or wherever it was. And I think it was from Dallas to San Jose. Austin was not on that flight. It's very possible that Steve Austin was not even aware that WWE had booked him on that flight. So he was booked on a flight by WWE, and he never checked in. And they also had a locker room at Levi's Stadium. Absolutely, PW Insider said they had multiple sources who said there was a locker room at Levi's Stadium for WrestleMania with Austin's name on it. So they expected him to be there, and he never showed up. All of the top guys had their names on their own locker rooms. I think everybody except The Rock, who I think they said dressed in an unmarked room. Austin had one with his name on it. So clearly they expected him to be there. And there were apparently plenty of people backstage who were talking about this. So I'm not saying that Austin is lying, because I don't think he is. I don't think Steve Austin is lying to his audience. I don't think he was aware of any of this. I don't think Austin knew that there was a locker room with his name on it at Levi's Stadium. And I don't think that he himself has heat with WWE, but that doesn't mean there isn't heat on the WWE side towards Steve Austin. There is clearly some very upset people there. Upset that he didn't show up at WrestleMania, and also upset that he said no to hosting Tough Enough. Now, Austin said he wanted to do it. He wanted to host Tough Enough again. He loved doing it the first time. He would have gladly done it. But what happened is they delayed shooting for so long. I think originally it was supposed to be filmed back in like February or something. They delayed it for so long that now he has his Broken Skull Challenge reality show that he has to do, and he just doesn't have time for it. You know, WWE expected Steve Austin to do it, and now he's not, and they're not happy about it. You know, and then the stuff with Chris Jericho doing his podcast now on the network instead of Austin, and we're going to talk about the Jericho podcast later on with John Cena. Austin admitted, he said, look, truth is, we couldn't reach a deal. We just couldn't reach a deal to make it happen. And then he kind of cryptically refused to talk about why or what happened. So from Austin's end, no problem. From WWE's end, that doesn't appear to be the case. But, you know, time heals all wounds. They'll work together again at some point. I would be shocked if Austin didn't at least make an appearance in Dallas at WrestleMania next year. I'm sure he will. He won't wrestle, but I'm sure he'll be there. But just what I would ask you is please consider the source before you blindly chalk something like this up to typical dirt sheet BS. There is a lot of typical dirt sheet BS that's out there from a lot of very unreliable sources. Okay, plenty of nonsense stories and rumors that get spread around on bogus sites and message boards. The trick is kind of figuring out the fact from the fiction. I'd like to think I'm pretty good at that. And so if you're the kind of person who doesn't really keep track of all that, you don't subscribe to this website and that website, and you pay for this, that, and the other, leave that to me. Okay, I'm pretty good at tracking what's going on, separating fact from fiction, pay attention to these guys, don't pay attention to those guys. Okay, so all you got to do is listen to this podcast, really, if you don't want to be bothered with that. But it rubbed me the wrong way, because automatically people say, well, Austin said there's no problem, so hey, Meltzer's an idiot, and PW Insider doesn't know what they're talking about, and the Torch is stupid. Like, that's not the case. Okay, don't be naive. That's all I would ask. Let's talk about Raw, shall we? Monday Night Raw this past week was live from Austin, Texas. First, the good. Byron Saxton filled in again for Michael Cole, so they did keep Cole off TV at least for 1 week. I was very happy to see that. I thought for sure he'd be there right back at the announce desk 1 week after Brock Lesnar murdered him, but he was not there. I was happy to also see Byron Saxton get another shot. I didn't think he would. I can't say he was great because he did the typical WWE robot style of announcing, but he was leaps and bounds better than what I heard from him the week before. He was acceptable. That's what I would say about Byron Saxton. He was acceptable. Adrian Neville only his second match on television, at least on Raw, I should say. He looked pretty good in there with the WWE Champion. Even in defeat, he had a match with Seth Rollins. I know that stirred up a lot of controversy this week, and we'll talk about that, but I thought he looked good. And I also thought WWE did the classy thing, and they acknowledged AJ Lee's retirement, her farewell tweet, the thank you AJ hashtag on Twitter that was trending. They could have easily ignored her retirement altogether, or worse, or much worse. But they took the high road, so that was nice to see. I'm also digging the John Cena Open Challenge that he's been doing. I like it. I like the fact that it gets him in there with some fresh opponents. And it looks like they're also turning the New Day heel, finally. I hate to even give them credit for it, because really it's the fans who turn the New Day heel. If it were up to Vince McMahon, they'd be the clapping, dancing, happy baby faces every single week for the next 3 years. So I hesitate to give them too much credit, but I do have to give them credit. At least the fans forced their hand, and now they're taking action. They're going in that. Same thing with Daniel Bryan, right? You can give them a little bit of credit, because in the end they did the right thing, but you can't give them too much credit, because they should have had enough foresight to see 6 months before the writing on the wall, and they just chose to ignore it. But they are going in that direction with the New Day. It's for the best. I mean, they were just a complete and utter failure as babyfaces. And I can't blame Big E or Kofi or Xavier. They did the best they could with it. I really don't think this is one of those gimmicks where you can say, well, maybe they bear a lot of the responsibility, because if the right people were in the role, the right people could have made that gimmick work. I really, honestly, in today's day and age, you know, maybe it would have been different 15, 20 years ago, but right now, that gimmick, there is nobody on the face of the earth that could have made that gimmick work to where the people would have gotten into it. I mean, you know, if you think of a comedy guy like a Santino, could Santino have made that work? I mean, in its current form, if we didn't know who Santino was, and they gave him this gimmick, and he really went over the top and started playing it up, maybe. I really don't know. I just think it's so cheesy and just so stupid. I really don't think there's anybody out there that could have made this work to any real degree. So I really don't want to put the blame on them. You know, they're three talented guys. Big E, I think, criminally underused. Kofi Kingston, in desperate need of a heel turn, has never been heel in his WWE run. I think he was a heel when he was in OVW or FCW, wherever he was when he first debuted. He may have been heel. I don't remember. But never, ever been heel in all the years he's been in WWE on the main roster. And now we're going to hopefully have a chance to see what he can do in that role. I don't know how far they're going to go with it. It could be almost like a comedy heel gimmick, not a serious like New Age Nation of Domination type of thing. Playing the race card and all that. And I'm not even saying they should necessarily do that. But at least they're finally doing something different. They realize it's not working, and we'll see what happens. We'll see what happens. But it was a long time coming. The bad on this show. We got another Big Show versus Roman Reigns match. And even worse, it may not be the last. I am beyond done with this feud. And I don't care what anybody says. It's not doing fuck all to get Roman Reigns over, okay? He'll have his cities where he gets a good reaction, and it has nothing to do, believe me, it has nothing to do with him beating Big Show every single week. It's not like him beating Big Show every single week is getting him more over. People don't like the Big Show. So generally, when he has a match with the Big Show, yes, Roman Reigns will get more cheers than Big Show will. And Roman Reigns, like on SmackDown Friday night or Thursday night, and I'm seeing now they're on the European tour, a lot of these cities like Belfast and places like that, Roman seems to be getting a pretty damn good reaction. Good. I'm happy for him. I think now that he didn't win the championship at WrestleMania, I figured people might be a little kinder to him because they just felt he doesn't deserve it, he's not ready, blah, 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 blah. Well, now WrestleMania has come and gone. Seth Rollins won, not Roman Reigns. And so people hopefully will lighten up on the guy a little bit. Because he doesn't deserve all of the criticism. He doesn't deserve the hate. Pure hatred. I see pure hatred out there for this guy. And I don't get it. I really don't get it. I don't understand it. He doesn't deserve that. But I tell you this right now. I mean, if their goal is to still get him over as the next big thing here and get everybody behind him, they got to put him in there with somebody. I mean, they can't. They can't keep putting him in there with the Big Show and Kane over and over and over and over again. The Big Show does not mean anything in 2015. And I'm not saying he doesn't have value, like he can't be entertaining. The Big Show can be entertaining. He can be. He's a naturally funny guy. You know what I think the Big Show has a future in all honesty? From what little bit I've seen of him and heard of him doing it, commentary. I really do. I mean, from the limited number of times I've seen Big Show do commentary, I know he's done it on SmackDown and Raw a couple of times here and there. He's pretty damn good. Now, I don't know if that's something he would want to do every single week when he retires, but you know what? Bump JBL out of there, and when Big Show's ready to hang it up, which hopefully will be this year, slot him over into the color guy role on Raw. Give him a shot. I'm game. I mean, anything to get JBL out of that booth, because talk about a guy that's gone from being, I thought, a really good announcer to being completely insufferable every single week. Maybe the Big Show has a future in commentary. So I shouldn't say he has no value at all, because that's not true. But what I mean is, the act of putting, let's say, Roman Reigns in there with the Big Show, and the, you know, the belief being, well, the Big Show's a giant. He's a 7-foot giant. And so Roman Reigns slaying the giant is going to help get Roman Reigns over. And I think, number one, I think that's probably an antiquated point of view. I mean, that might work with, Brock and somebody smaller, like the David versus Goliath story. But we see Brock Lesnar very seldomly, and Brock Lesnar is a hell of a lot more protected than the Big Show is. We've seen the Big Show on television every single week, week after week after week, for 15, 16 years now. The Big Show is the kind of guy who should have been protected the way Brock Lesnar has been in his most recent run. He should have been that special attraction, like Andre the Giant back in the day. But, you know, television being what it is, and, you know, the Big Show's a full-time member of the roster. He's doing all the house shows. He's doing Raw every week and SmackDown every week. And so, yeah, he's 7 feet tall, 500 pounds, but guess what? There's nothing special about him. What is so special about the Big Show? And so I don't see the benefit in constantly putting him in there with Roman Reigns as though we're supposed to be impressed. Ooh, Roman Reigns has beaten the Big Show. Guess what? Everybody at some point has fucking beaten the Big Show. That's not gonna do much. That's not going to accomplish much. Just because he won the Battle Royal at WrestleMania, it doesn't make it any better. I have seen all that I want to see from Brock Lesnar, from Roman Reigns and the Big Show. So, anyway, that's my little mini rant on this. They also blew off the very first Miz vs. Mizdow match on this show in the 10:45 p.m. death spot, no less. Instead of just saving it for the next pay-per-view, saving their first singles match for Extreme Rules, they just couldn't help themselves. They put it on this show. And again, maybe if it was slotted a little bit better, it wouldn't have been so bad. But not only did they blow it off on this show, but they did it in the second-to-last segment on the show when people have been sitting there for 2 hours and 40 minutes. I mean, they're just, you know, people were mostly dead for the match. And I mean, there's really no great surprise why that is. I mean, by that time of the show every single week, it's a long show. People are dead, man. They're tired. They're like, all right, they're looking at their watch. They're looking at the clock. It's like, all right, I get it. Let's go here, you know. And so, unfortunately, it didn't get the kind of reaction, I think, that it probably would have gotten earlier in the show or on the next pay-per-view. And I'm sure they're going to end up having a match anyway at Extreme Rules, but I really think it was a big mistake to blow it off here like this. I just think it's just inexcusable. And then there's the ugly. So we did the good, the bad, and now the ugly. That Divas match. Holy shit. This was atrocious. And we're getting a battle royal with these women on TV this week. God help us all if it's anything like this match. Some other thoughts from the show overall. Many of you tweeted me that you thought they had already announced on SmackDown the week before, which I did not see. So if I'm wrong here, I blame you people. But I got multiple people who said, man, you know, I could have sworn that on SmackDown this past week, Randy Orton would be the one challenging Seth Rollins for the WWE Championship at Extreme Rules, only for them to then turn around on this show and build the entire show on Monday night around the storyline of who gets the next shot, Randy Orton, Ryback, or Roman Reigns. I don't know how many times I have to tell you people, if it happens on SmackDown, it didn't happen. It's as simple as that. SmackDown may have some good wrestling, even great wrestling, some weeks. I've seen it. You know, I tune in every now and then when they had the Intercontinental Gauntlet stuff and Bryan vs. Ziggler. I tuned in for that. It was pretty good stuff. But it is an utterly missable show. There is no sense of urgency that anybody gets to have to sit down and watch SmackDown any given week. If you sit through 3 hours of Raw every Monday night, there is absolutely no need for you to watch SmackDown. Now, if you don't watch Raw and SmackDown is the only thing you watch, then fine. That's a different story. But you should not feel compelled to watch the show for fear of missing anything important, storyline-wise, because you won't. If it's that important, they'll air a replay on Raw, or they'll just redo the whole entire segment anyway. Word for word, move for move, I don't care if it's a promo, a match, they'll just redo it on Monday night. Now, we'll see if that changes when the show moves to USA next year, and if it goes live, but, you know, I'm sure it will for the first few weeks, and then after that, it'll be right back to the status quo. That's what always happens. If they have a show that's in a new time slot or switching networks, when SmackDown moved to Thursdays, right, for about a week or two, it was kind of a big deal. They had the big casket match, Daniel Bryan and Kane. That was Bryan's first match back after 8 months on the shelf, and that was kind of important, right? People wanted to tune in to see that. Didn't take very long for SmackDown to fall right back to where it was. Like I said, an utterly missable show. That's what SmackDown is. Anyway, they're clearly setting Kane up to split from the Authority and go back to being Masked Demon Kane. See, once they put the mask back on him, and they will put the mask back on him, mark my words, he's going to start getting big reactions again. Guaranteed. It always happens, without fail. There's something about that mask. This guy has had quite a long career, largely because he goes through these shitty storylines, or they'll unmask him, and they'll do something stupid with him, or they'll de-push him. But then as soon as he becomes the monster again and they put that mask back on, the people go nuts for the guy. I mean, I give him a lot of credit, and I'm sure it's going to happen again. So I guess we'll just have to wait and see exactly how that all goes down. Rollins was out there talking about how WrestleMania was a big night for the Authority with him winning the championship and Triple H beating Sting, the Big Show winning the Andre the Giant Memorial Battle Royal, and Kane, well, Kane was there, he said. And he was, in fact, there. He was not lying. Triple H and Stephanie were legitimately away. They were on vacation this week. So Kane was left in charge as the director of operations, and he announced that Randy Orton, Ryback, and Roman Reigns would have a triple threat match at the end of the show to determine who meets Rollins for the championship at the pay-per-view. But each man would first have to wrestle a singles match, and Kane said that he would be Orton's opponent, Randy Orton, who is the one getting the championship shot at Extreme Rules, could not even beat Kane. They had Kane get himself DQ'd by using a steel chair. That's kind of sad. Brad Maddox made a brief cameo, and when I say brief, I mean if you blinked, you would have missed it, in a backstage segment with Kane. My karaoke buddy, back on Raw. Sadly, he was not singing One Direction. They're now saying that Michael Cole suffered a bulging disc as a result of last week's F5 from Brock Lesnar, not a cervical spinal injury, as they said the week before, which was incredibly tone-deaf for them to do, coming off the whole Perro Aguayo thing. Obviously, they realized it, and they made the change. There was no mention of cervical anything this week. They also teased that Cole was considering a lawsuit against Brock Lesnar. Word of advice, if I may, if he wants to live, I would advise against doing that. Just take that for what it's worth. We had Seth Rollins and Adrian Neville one-on-one. Neville now has a spiffy new superhero-like entrance. They show, the galaxy as part of his Titantron, and there may be a rocket ship in there. I don't really remember. He's got pyro. He's got dry ice and smoke. So, you know, they did it up real nice. I guess we'll see 6 weeks from now if he still has the same entrance or if they tone it down. So he came out for a match. Rollins, of course, thought this whole thing was a joke. He's like, you're my opponent? And looking at Rollins next to Neville, it was a stark difference in terms of height. Rollins is actually pretty tall. I think Rollins is a deceptively tall man. You don't really look at him on television and think he's that tall, but he's a big dude. And Adrian Neville, not so much. He's actually quite small. But I wanted to talk a little bit about this because there are a lot of people out there, people on whether it's our group or other places, there are a lot of smart people out there who get it. They get it. They saw this match, and what they saw is that this guy who just debuted the week before, he got some offense in on the champion. He hung with him. The fans were behind him. He fell short in the end. He did lose. He didn't beat Seth Rollins, but he looked good. I wouldn't say it was a great showcase. A great showcase would be like they did on SmackDown again with Neville and Curtis Axel, where it's pretty much just a one-man show, and Neville is showing off all of his moves and the wacky flips and dives and the red arrow. That's a great showcase. I would say this was a good showcase. He got beaten down quite a bit by Rollins, but again, he fought back. He had some offense in on him. The people seemed to buy into it. So I would say it was a good night for Neville. And you have, on the other hand, people who don't really get it, who are all up in arms. Oh, they buried him. Neville was buried. 2 weeks in, he's already 6 feet under here on this show. They didn't bury him. Okay, he got some offense in on the champion. Like I said, he hung with the guy, and he fell short, as he should have, because Seth Rollins is the WWE World Heavyweight Champion, in case you forgot. Now, here's the thing. I would not have done the match at all, okay? Not this early. At some point, yes, but not this early. Second week in, I would not have booked this match, because me personally, I just would rather this guy get a few wins under his belt, look good, and then you start increasing the level of competition. It's kind of like he debuts, and then the very next week, he's in the main event almost, right? He's in there with the champ. What do? You can't have him beat Rollins, because it's not like he's going to beat him and then challenge him for the championship at Extreme Rules, which, by the way, I would totally do. I see no reason for them not to, but they have their little formula where it's the same fucking five or six guys. But anyway, I just would not have booked the match at all. I just think you save that match for later on when you want to beat Neville and he's a little more established with the mainstream non-NXT audience. But that being said, doing this match the way they did it and him losing just because he lost, he is not buried. He got beaten by the champion. I've said this before. Words matter. And people don't understand what the definition of the word burial is. There is no hard and fast definition for the word buried. You just kind of understand. You know when it's appropriate and when it's not. I do. A lot of you do. But unfortunately, there are some people who don't. And they think that when you lose a match, you're buried. He wasn't buried. Can we please just knock that shit off? We had the John Cena U.S. Title Open Challenge. This week it was Stardust accepting. And Cena beat Stardust after kicking out of his Crossroads finish and hitting his bizarre-looking springboard stunner off the ropes. Then he hit the AA for the pin. Cody hit Cena with a sick-looking DDT during this match. They even replayed it a whole bunch of times. I mean, it just looked brutal. That was pretty cool. He also potatoed Cena very early in the match. His eye was swelling up as the match went on. It was a little... It didn't look like they were on the same page, maybe in the first few minutes, but then after that, things kind of settled in, and it turned into a pretty good match. And again, you had people saying, well, Stardust was buried. He lost to John Cena. Buried. Not buried. Maybe he likes berries, you know? Maybe he likes strawberry, blueberry, raspberry, huckleberry, I don't know. But in terms of being buried by losing this match, the answer is no. In fact, had Stardust not been in the ring with John Cena, the United States champion here, he probably wouldn't have even been on the show. So not only was he on the show, they had a pretty long... I didn't clock it on my stopwatch. It felt like it went every bit of 10, 12 minutes. It wasn't a quick 3-minute squash. Again, I don't see how people can watch a match like that and think, oh, Stardust was buried. Ask yourself this question. And this could be applied to a lot of other guys, not just Stardust, okay? Stardust is a mid-card guy. Now, you could argue he should be higher up than he is, maybe not main event, but he's very good. So whether it's as Cody Rhodes or as Stardust, and by the way, I am getting a little more into the Stardust character each week. I mean, he has thrown himself into this character, and he's changing his outfits, and I'm starting to dig Stardust, the whole gimmick, more and more each week. But he's a mid-card guy. That's it. Nothing more, nothing less. That is where he is slotted, and that is what he is. He was one of seven bodies in a ladder match at WrestleMania. Had no chance of winning. Week to week, sometimes he's on the show, sometimes he isn't. Always better to be on the show than not. And most weeks when he is on the show, it's in a meaningless match. He's in the ring with another mid-card goofball, and it doesn't mean anything. This week, He accepted John Cena's open challenge. John Cena, the biggest star in the company, he accepted his open challenge. It was a championship match. It was a competitive match. They went back and forth. It went 10 minutes or more. And in the end, he fell short. No burial. No burial. Stardust would kill to be in the ring with John Cena every single week. When I had the chance to do some of the media stuff at WrestleMania in Miami a few years ago, I had the opportunity to sit in on the pre-show press conference on WrestleMania Day. So a few hours before WrestleMania, there I am. I'm sitting there. They're trotting out John Cena and The Rock and all these different guys. And I asked John Cena a question. I said, are there any guys on the roster right now? And this was in 2012. So this goes back 3 years. I said, are there any guys on the roster right now, maybe younger guys that you haven't had a chance to work with, that you see big things for, that you'd like to work with later on? And one of the guys that he name-dropped, he actually singled him out, was Cody Rhodes. So I'm sure John Cena actually sees a lot of potential in Cody Rhodes. Maybe they're friendly. I don't know what their relationship is behind the scenes. But this was 3 years ago when I asked him the question, and Cena specifically name-dropped Cody Rhodes. So I'm sure from Cena's end, he was more than happy to work with Cody and kind of let him, have a little bit of the rub. But it was not, it was not his night. It was not a night for Stardust to win the U.S. title. It would not have made sense. This whole open challenge thing, this is meant to go on for a while. This is a long-term thing here. And I don't know if they're going to do my idea of building to a match with Bryan and having the two main event guys with mid-card titles fight it out at SummerSlam, which I think would be a great idea, or if they're going to let this go for a couple more months and then have somebody new from NXT or Samoa Joe or whoever pop up one week and be the one to beat John Cena. Whatever their plan is, it's still a ways off. So you have to expect that each week that goes by, when a new person comes out, they're not going to suddenly beat John Cena. Maybe at some point they're building to that. But for now, Cena has to beat people. Who do you want him to beat? You want him to beat main event guys? You want him to beat Zack Ryder? I'd put Stardust a little higher than Zack Ryder. He's got to be in there with guys that he can be competitive with. So I thought it was a good night for Stardust. And I'm sure this week, they probably won't have anything as meaningful for him. But they should, because Stardust is actually pretty good. He's another guy who I think they're not doing enough with. Naomi and Paige beat the Bella Twins when Naomi used something that I think was supposed to resemble a Rana into the mat, but absolutely looked nothing like it, and got the pin. This match sucked. It was terrible. 4 minutes and 58 seconds, so roughly 5 minutes on the Diva stopwatch. So we're already back down to the 4 or 5 minute range, down from the 11 and 12 minutes that we were getting. I knew that wouldn't take long. And that 4 minutes and 58 seconds was 4 minutes and 57 seconds too long. It was just one long succession of botch. I don't even know if you can call it a match. It was just like one long botch. It's like AJ Lee retired and all of a sudden they forgot how to wrestle. And Naomi usually is very good. And she changed her look, her hair and everything. And I'm not really a fan. I liked it better when she had the straighter hair. But not that that matters. But she changed her look and everything. They're clearly positioning her as the number one contender. I mean, maybe not after this week. But that was certainly the plan for Extreme Rules. So I would expect that she'll win the Battle Royal on Monday night, unless they saw this match and they're like, that's not happening. Let's call an audible here. But normally she's actually pretty damn good, but not tonight. We had Brie accidentally knock out Nikki for the second time that's happened now. So they are building to another split between the Bella Twins. Oh, joy. I cannot wait to see that. I hope it's as riveting as it was the first time, and with that great payoff that we got, too. This was just awful. Just not a good week for the women. Ryback beat Luke Harper in a two-minute match. You know, this is kind of of a recurring theme here as far as mid-card guys that WWE should be doing more with. Luke Harper certainly fits into that category. I think it's shameful. It is absolutely shameful what they have done with this man since they broke up the Wyatt family. And I can sit here now, however many months later now, 6 months later, that it's been since they broke up the Wyatt family. Okay, it was one thing to break up the Shield if they had bigger plans for those three as single stars. And you can say that it's paid off because two of the three members of the Shield, which I hadn't even realized until somebody pointed it out to me, but, you know, two-thirds of the Shield was in this year's WrestleMania main event. Ambrose was actually the odd man out, which I never would have expected. But yeah, two-thirds of the Shield in this year's WrestleMania main event. And so they would be in a much worse position, I think, without those three guys on the roster. So breaking up the Shield, as horrible as that was for all of us who love watching the Shield, there was absolutely, positively no reason to break up the Wyatt family. I said it when it happened, and now I can look back on it all these months later, hindsight being 2020, all that garbage, and I can say that I was absolutely right. I don't feel any differently. If anything, I feel even more strongly that it was a stupid, dumb shit move for them to do that. Eric Rowan, a complete lost cause. And we knew that was going to happen. I said, of the three, Eric Rowan's going to go bye-bye. Because on his own, there is nothing about the Eric Rowan character or even him as a worker that stands out. He's, you know, he's good, and that's it. But guess what? Just being good is not good enough. So he was going to fall to the wayside no matter what. Once they broke up, that was inevitable. Bray Wyatt is going to be the big star. He'll be a champion at some point. Everything was always built around him. He was the leader, right? But Harper is kind of the wild card here. Harper is a big guy who can go, man. Harper is a big guy who can work. He can fly. He's got that character down. And from what I've heard of him, you know, before even coming to WWE, I don't think he's a terrible promo either. We just haven't had a chance to really see that yet. So you talk about a guy that has a lot of potential and who is not being used to that full potential. Luke Harper is near the top of that list in WWE. Out of everybody on that roster, he's near the top. He's got the size. It's just kind of puzzling to me that this is what they're doing with him. He's got no direction. He loses all the time. Loses and loses and loses and loses. And it'd be one thing, I guess, if he lost, but they had a storyline direction for him, but they don't. I mean, I guess Ambrose will come back maybe this week and get some revenge for what he did to Ambrose. It looks like maybe they're doing something with the two of them. Maybe they'll have a match at Extreme Rules. But it just feels like they don't know what to do with this guy. I mean, I'd be inclined to just put them back together. Put the Wyatt family back together. Never should have broken him up in the first place. The Lucha Dragons beat Green Day in a quick match. People once again chanted New Day sucks at them as they further their heel turn. A lot of very subtle heel mannerisms and facial expressions, especially from Xavier Woods. Got to pay attention to his face and some of the things that they do. There was a point in this match, I think, where they cheated. There was a spot where they cheated. Maybe the ref's back was turned and Kofi or somebody hit the guy from behind from the outside and they were showing Xavier and he had this look on his face like he was kind of troubled, but then he kind of smiled like, oh, okay. Like, he's starting to see how it is, how it really is, what they have to do to get by here. It's very subtle, but I appreciate the subtleties. Roman Reigns beat The Big Show in their 25th match of this year, and I don't think I'm exaggerating too far when I throw that number out there. Big Show did do a baseball slide to the floor at one point. That was interesting to see. Fans were mostly into Roman here, which is good. Took three Superman punches and a spear to beat the Giant. Heel Sheamus came out to more chance of you look stupid. That's the point, people. He's supposed to. Mark Henry came out in his home state of Texas to decent reaction and was quickly squashed with a brogue kick. We got our first Bray Wyatt promo since the loss to Undertaker at WrestleMania. Still calling himself the new face of fear. He is apparently targeting somebody new who we do not know who it is. He did not identify this person. But I am predicting that it ends up being Roman Reigns. That is my prediction. The Miz beat Damian Mizdow. He rolled him up with a fistful of tights. Idiotic that they would give their first match away after months and months of building this up. And building to a moment that the people were just dying for. And I guess they kind of got it at WrestleMania in the Battle Royal when he punched Miz and he threw him out. But they built this up for so long and they've not had one single one-on-one match on television. This was the first one. And this is where they had it. This is where they did it. This is how they did it. They put it in the death spot on this show. A total throwaway match. Crowd wasn't even much into it because the show is too damn long. If there are two things I'm sure of in this life, and you may have to be from New York to get the reference here, but it is this. The rent is too damn high, and this show is too damn long. Mizdow could not believe that he lost. I could. Main event was Randy Orton, Ryback, and Roman Reigns for the right to meet Seth Rollins for the championship at Extreme Rules. We had Rollins, Big Show, and J&J Security. They came down about midway through the match. Roman Reigns did another one of his crazy, reckless dives out over the top rope onto all the heels, wiped them out. And then the Big Show proceeded to deliver not one, but two knockout punches and laid out Roman Reigns on the outside, just flat on his back. So Roman beat Big Show for the millionth time in the middle of the show. And you think at that point, okay, we've gotten our fill. Now we can move on from there. But nope, knocked him out, which can only lead one to surmise that they're going to have a match at Extreme Rules. Now, I do not know this. It is not official. They have not announced it. But they will have a match at Extreme Rules, and it'll have some stupid stipulation, I'm sure. Maybe a stairs match. Ooh. We've seen Big Show in a lot of really dumb stipulation matches over the years. We've seen the Big Show in a chairs match. Remember when Big Show had his giant chair that he used on Sheamus when he won the world title? We've seen Big Show against Eric Rowan in a stairs match. An epically awful encounter that was. Maybe it'll be some combination of chairs and stairs. Ooh. That's exactly what Roman needs to get over. So that was Raw. Randy Orton won, by the way. Forgot to mention that. So he is going to challenge Rollins for the championship at Extreme Rules in what I am sure will be a very good match. Rollins laid him out with a curb stomp and posed over his dead body at the end of the show with the title, and that was Raw. And that led us to the first ever episode of, what'd they call it? Was it Live with Chris Jericho, I think is the name of it? His podcast interview on the WWE Network with John Cena. So what I'm going to do here, I'm not going to go through everything they talked about. I'm going to go through some of the highlights, throw some comments in here, and then move on. Because to be honest with you, overall, it was a very dull interview. There was really not, you didn't learn much of anything here that you didn't already know, except maybe the heel turn stuff. Although if you listen to this podcast, then you knew that already. You didn't need to hear John Cena talk about it. I just talked about that a few weeks ago. The heel turn that never was a few years ago. That maybe was the most interesting part of the interview. You know, my overall impression of it is this. It's hard to compare, you know, Jericho and Austin. If I had to pick one over the other, I prefer Austin's method of interviewing. But it's just two totally different styles. You almost can't compare them. It's unfair to compare. They're not the same kind of interview. It's not like one guy is more probing than the other. Jericho was not out there to probe. He was out there really almost to have a conversation with a friend, a chat with a friend, and then from that these funny, interesting stories kind of come out of that. I enjoyed it. I mean, I like Jericho's style, and I like Austin's style. I just happen to think that Austin's style of interviewing lends itself more to these kinds of things. And it's more a case where Austin is likely to ask the questions, the real questions that people want to hear, more than Jericho is. Jericho played it safe to an extent. I feel like the steroid question he threw in there because he knew he couldn't just throw softballs at Cena the whole time. It couldn't just be a casual, friendly chat. He had to at least have one question in there that was like, ooh, he went there. And so that was the steroid question. But otherwise, it was just, you know, two guys shooting the shit. And that's fine. But if you ask me, what do I prefer that you have a guy out there asking the questions that I would like to hear answers to. And you didn't really get that with this interview. But, I liked it for what it was. Jericho brought up Cena's five moves of doom and how now he's added a springboard stunner and a Michinoku driver. They joked about whether they could even use those names, which is very sad, you know, that they can't even use those names. But Cena talked about the original five moves of doom. He actually named them. He named the original five moves of doom. He was joking. He said two of them were shoulder blocks. And then the rest, we all know the rest. So at least he's able to poke fun at himself. Jericho said that when he was the world champion in 2009, and he was working with Rey Mysterio, he felt that it was kind of a way to bring the belt up. And this is when they started talking about the idea that John Cena now is the United States champion. And there are people who will, you know, he's looking at it as a demotion of some kind. And Cena said he doesn't look at it that way. I mean, what else is he going to say? But he doesn't look at it that way. He looks at it as a way to maybe help elevate some new guys, try something different, which people are always complaining, John Cena, same old shit, do something different. Well, they're kind of doing that now with the open challenge. I dig it so far. I like it. And Jericho just kind of relayed his own experiences of, you know, he was the world champion in 2008, wrestling in main events with Shawn Michaels, one of the greatest feuds that company's ever had. And then the year after that, he's fighting over the Intercontinental title with Rey Mysterio. And they had some awesome matches that year. And his point was, he felt it was just his way of bringing the belt up. It was helping to elevate the championship, which they did for a while. And Cena said that, you know, if you have a title, you want to do everything you can to make it mean the most. And Jericho pointed out that, you know, the open challenge can help do that. I just thought it was funny to hear these two guys pretty much in a roundabout way admitting that these mid-card titles in WWE have been treated like shit for so long. I mean, we didn't need to hear it from them to know that it's true, but it was nice to kind of hear them acknowledge it. And maybe now they're starting to make an effort to change that. Daniel Bryan's the Intercontinental Champion. John Cena's the U.S. Champion. I don't expect either guy to be beat for a long time. So maybe finally champs are not chumps. Do I have confidence that when these two guys drop those belts that things are going to be different? Not really. I have no reason to. I have no reason to be confident about that. But for the time being, it's nice to see. Cena talked about the night he debuted on SmackDown, that match with Kurt Angle, ruthless aggression. And said that the only reason that even happened was because Undertaker was supposed to wrestle Angle, I think, on that show, and was not there. Now, I don't know if that's true. That's the first I'm hearing of it. It may be true. I did not know that. So you'll learn something new, I guess. So Undertaker wasn't there. Cena went out, and the rest is history. I say the rest is history. You know, I mean, to be perfectly honest, though, you know, it was a memorable debut for John Cena. He hung with Kurt Angle. He didn't win, kind of like Neville and Rollins. But he looked good. But after that, they didn't really do a whole lot with Cena. And Cena, actually, he didn't talk about this, but Cena came very close to being cut. And Stephanie McMahon is the one who saw him or got wind of him rapping and freestyling, and she liked it and thought he had something there. And that's how the whole gimmick came about. So Cena can thank Stephanie for saving his job, because he would have been on the chopping block. So even though he had that great debut against Kurt Angle and Jericho put him over in their first feud, it didn't really do much, apparently, because he was very close to losing his job. Wait a minute. Undertaker was on that show when Cena debuted on SmackDown in 02. Undertaker actually had a segment in the back with Cena when the match was over where he shook his hand. Undertaker absolutely was on that show. So he's full of shit. Anyway, Cena thanked Jim Cornette and Danny Davis from the OVW days for all that they did for him. I know Jim Cornette gave Cena a shout-out on Twitter, showing him some love. Then Jericho asked Cena the question about steroids and drug testing, and I made a joke on Twitter. I said, oh well, can't wait for Live with Sergeant Slaughter next month. Actually, I wouldn't be surprised if they did that. But yeah, he went there, he asked him about performance-enhancing drugs. John Cena says he's never done it. He doesn't do it now. He's never done it before. He's been consistent, if nothing else, over the years. He's always said that he's never done anything. They showed old photos of him from his bodybuilding days and what he looked like back then. And, you know, the idea that he has never done anything, look, nobody can prove him wrong. Nobody has evidence to the contrary, so who am I to say? I'll keep my opinions to myself, but the one thing I will say about Cena, as far as his body in WWE, his physical appearance, his body really has not changed much at all. So I will say that. He has been consistent as far as his physique. Does that mean he's clean? No. But he has been consistent, at least as far as that goes. And as far as my own opinions on things, I'll keep that to myself. But he has always said he's never done anything, and he at one point even said that he felt that any kind of drug user, steroid user, should be incarcerated. So if you are busted, for example, using anabolic steroids, you should be thrown in jail. I don't know if he still feels that way, but I know he did make that comment at one time, so he feels strongly about it. They talked a lot about the Rock vs. Cena feud from 2012 and that whole program, and that actually led into maybe the most interesting part of the whole interview, which was Cena being asked if he would ever turn heel, and if he's open to the idea of a heel turn. And Cena said that it was actually discussed briefly during the program with The Rock in the build-up to the first match at WrestleMania 28. He was told they were thinking about it, and so just in case, Cena said he ran out, he had new music made, and he went and ordered new gear. So he was actually going to be wearing, I think, actual wrestling tights and boots. He was going to just change everything up, which is hilarious to me because one of the things I think that people always hated about John Cena, and one of the reasons they would boo him, is that it's always with the jean shorts. It's the jean shorts and the sneakers. He doesn't look like a wrestler. He doesn't look like one. He doesn't wear wrestling boots. He doesn't wear wrestling trunks. So I find it funny that his idea for a heel turn was to go change his whole look and possibly put tights and boots on, because that probably would get him cheered more than anything else. Actually, I guarantee you that if John Cena ever turned heel, he would get more cheers than he does now. So that's kind of why I think it's completely pointless at this point to even consider doing a heel turn with him. I mean, if the right circumstance were to come along, then fine. But, the fans would just start cheering him. That's what would happen. He's already the biggest heel in the company, so why bother? Why bother changing anything? I just want to hear this heel John Cena music that apparently is sitting on a hard drive somewhere. That's what I want to hear. He said that if it happened, it would have been great. The way he talked about, he was very genuine in talking about what it means to the Make-A-Wish kids, and not even the Make-A-Wish kids, just every little kid, every little John Cena fan out there. All the little C-Nation members who look up to this guy and what it means to him to be kind of a role model for them. But you can just hear it in his voice. If he had the chance, if they came to him and said, listen, we're going to pull the trigger, you're going to be a villain, he would eat that shit up. You know that this guy, this poor guy has been held hostage by this company and Vince McMahon in some ways, creatively held hostage by them for so long. If it were up to him, he probably would have turned heel 5 years ago. And I think he'd be pretty good at it too. Because you gotta imagine there's a lot of pent-up frustration there. I don't care what he says. There's got to be a lot of pent-up frustration over these reactions over the years that has just been building and building and building. And I think for him to one day be able to finally throw it back in everybody's face would be awesome. And it's not like we've never seen Cena do the heel thing before. When he was heel rapper John Cena, he was pretty good at it. You know, he was a pretty good douchebag back in the day. So I'm sure he would love to do it. He would jump at the chance. But he's their cash cow, and they don't want to take a chance. They don't want to rock the boat. So that was pretty much the gist of the interview. I mean, he told some other fun stories, like road stories, being on the road early in his career with Funaki and Tajiri and stuff like that. And Jericho brought up a story that he talked about in his book, his most recent book, which, by the way, you can pick up the audio book version of it right now using our Audible link, audibletrial.com/Solomonster. Pick up Jericho's book that came out this past fall. It's actually really good. In fact, I did a review of the book on our YouTube channel, so you can head over there and check it out. There's a story in the book where he and Cena are hanging out one night, doing some drinking. This is the story that Cena told where he was giving some, he was doing some marriage counseling with this couple that was on the outs that they found at the bar. And Jericho woke up the next morning. Somebody had tucked him into bed, and he woke up, and there's John Cena sitting across the room, you know, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, listening to his iPod. Jericho's iPod, that is. Jericho was completely freaked out by this. Still drinking, I believe, Cena was, in the morning. So it's a fun story, but anybody who read his book or listened to his book probably already heard it. It was just fun, you know? It was just a fun 60-minute chat between two friends, two colleagues. There wasn't really a lot of pushing. There weren't a lot of hard questions. It was very different from what you would expect from a Steve Austin interview. That's my preferred style when it comes to this stuff, but by no means was this bad. And I think even if Austin had done this interview, because Austin has interviewed John Cena on his podcast before, just not on the network, but he was on Cena's bus last year at some point, I think, and sat with him one-on-one face-to-face and did an interview that was pretty good, but it's John Cena. That's the other thing here. You know, consider the subject. The subject here was John Cena, and John Cena is not going to say anything controversial. He'll come off as the nicest guy in the world, the consummate company man, but you're not going to get a whole lot out of John Cena that you haven't already heard 1,000 times before. So I think we'll get a better sense of how these are going to go next month and the month after when we see who else Jericho. I think it's a monthly thing, so they didn't announce who his next subject would be. I'd like to see him maybe do something like an interview with Stephanie McMahon. I would love somebody to interview The Undertaker, and I would prefer that it be Austin. And I really think that would be a huge deal. If Austin can do a podcast for the network and get Undertaker on there, or even if Austin could just get Undertaker on his regular podcast, like go down to Texas and to his house and just record something, That's the one guy who, above all else, now that Vince McMahon has already been interviewed, I would love to hear The Undertaker do one of these things. And anything's possible. Austin did say that, you know, a year or two ago, he did bring it up with Taker, and Taker said he would be down for it. This was, I think, before WrestleMania last year, even. And they just haven't been able to work out their schedule. So it is possible at some point Austin will do an interview with Undertaker. I just think it would be foolish not to try to do that on the network, because that would easily be the most watched thing they've ever had on that network. Jericho was already saying that apparently this podcast with Cena was the number three most watched show of any kind ever on the WWE network. Well, John Cena is a big star, but again, you're not going to get anything controversial out of him. That's why it would always annoy me when Michael Cole would go on television and say, John Cena is the most controversial superstar in WWE today or in WWE history, and I would want to bang my head against the wall. Because there is absolutely nothing controversial whatsoever about John Cena. In fact, John Cena is probably the least controversial wrestler on the entire roster. Polarizing is the right word. And after I started crowing about it week after week after week, finally, all of a sudden, they had Michael Cole going out there on television saying, John Cena is polarizing, and Jerry Lawler saying, oh, what a polarizing figure he is. And so, whatever happened, I'm glad it happened, because that's the more appropriate word. It would just be funny to me. It wasn't just that they were using the wrong word. It was of all the people on that roster to say that they're controversial. John Cena, he's like a fucking Boy Scout. There is nothing controversial about this guy. And finally, they came to their senses and they started calling him polarizing, which is exactly what he is. He is that. There are a lot of people who will fall on one side of the fence or the other. Very extreme views people have of John Cena. They either really, really love the guy or they really, really hate the guy. And that is what makes him so polarizing. I thought actually the best part was at the end when Jericho was plugging his podcast this week and he said he would have Eddie Guerrero on the show. And then he corrected himself and said Vicky Guerrero. It's a good thing he clarified that. All I could think is, he waited 10 years just to come back on Jericho's podcast? What a letdown.
I'm actually not wearing pants, and that's how I watch NXT every single week.
Not counting the TakeOver specials, this may have been my favorite episode of NXT ever. Which is not bad considering I expected nothing more than a highlight show this week. And the matches that we did get, we all knew the outcomes to. This was the Hideo Itami coming out episode, really, is what it was. They did a better job at getting you to care about this guy than anything they have done with him so far up to this point. Than anything they've done maybe with anybody on their roster, period. That's how good of a job they did getting this guy over. Is likable, somebody that you really cared about and wanted to see succeed. It was impossible to come away from this not liking Hideo Itami. Impossible. The only thing that brought it down for me was that Andre the Giant Memorial Battle Royal and how little they did with him in that match. I'm not saying that Itami had to win the entire thing. He could have, but he didn't have to. But they did such a good job with that video package at the end of the show this week. Just getting you invested in his WrestleMania journey, his whole WrestleMania story. That to have him eliminated the way that he was, as quickly as he was, it just didn't really fit the story they were trying to tell. You watch this and you think, oh, he's winning the whole thing. Or at the very least, he's one of the last guys in that ring before getting dumped. And when he gets punched in the face by Big Show the way that he was, it just fell flat. Kind of like Hideo did on the floor. To them, I could see WWE saying, hey, he got eliminated by the guy who eventually went on to win the entire thing. Nothing to hang your head about. I still see no reason why the Big Show had to win that thing over Mizdow. Because Damian Mizdow was my pick. I would not have even picked Hideo Itami, even if I knew he was going to be in there, weeks earlier. Mizdow was my pick. So whether it's Mizdow, Itami, they had a chance to get somebody new or get somebody lower on the card over and give them a big win on the biggest show of the year. But we got the Big Show just so that we... And this is, by the way, the only reason Big Show won this Battle Royal. The only reason that Big Show won that Battle Royal was so that we can get months of camera shots of him standing next to the Andre the Giant Memorial Trophy with his arms crossed like Andre is on the trophy. On the top of the trophy, Andre's there with his arms crossed. That's the only reason he won that Battle Royal. What a colossal waste. What a waste. They showed highlights from the opening round of the tournament at Fan Access during WrestleMania week to determine who would go on to be in the Andre the Giant Memorial Battle Royal at WrestleMania. So this was not a clip show so much. They did have clips of the first round matches, but they actually had some first run matches, even though they were dated. They have never aired them before. This was before WrestleMania. What they did air, it came down to Adrian Neville against Hideo Itami in one of the semifinal matches, and what I believe would have been their first match together ever, I'm pretty sure, and Finn Balor against Tyler Breeze. The winner of each of those matches would go on to meet one another in the main event for the right to go to WrestleMania. They aired these matches and the finals in full, so this was the closest thing to the old King of the Ring tournament that we're going to get. It really is. If you think about it, that's the format that they were using in more recent years anyway. For the King of the Ring, they would show you the two semifinal matches in the finals, and then they would crown a winner. Closest thing we're going to get to that. I love the atmosphere in the convention center there. Just a couple of hundred fans all standing up, crowded around the ring. Kind of looked like an indie show. And the matches were pretty damn good, too. I thought Itami and Neville had the best match. Neville was playing up some heel tendencies, something fierce during his match. He was outright just blatantly playing the role of heel in that match. At one point, he was pointing to a fan off camera. He was threatening to come out after them, and then he decided to spare his life. Crowd was big time into Itami, even though I'm sure nobody honestly thought he would win, at least not the entire thing. I think we all figured out, figuring it was going to be Neville or Balor. That's certainly what I thought. But anyway, Itami won with a kick to the face. All I can say is, Itami and Neville, watch this match. It was quite good. Then we had Finn Balor and Tyler Breeze. No full entrances for either man, just pretty much right into it. We got the tail end of Finn Balor's entrance when we came back. And we were off to the races. I still pop whenever the referee backs Tyler Breeze off. Like when he backs him away from his opponent and Breeze just snaps at him and says, "Don't touch me!" It's one of the greatest things in wrestling. Balor won with the double foot stomp off the top to set up a match with Itami in the finals. A most worthy King of the Ring final, if they were to ever bring that tournament back, would be Hideo Itami and Finn Balor. Really good match they had. Again, I would probably give the edge to Itami and Neville, partially also because we've never seen that match before. Neville or Itami and Balor we have. But this was a damn good match. Crowd was into both guys. They were shocked when Itami won. He went for the GTS. Tons of teases on this show for the GTS all night long. This was the one where even I thought he would hit it. And I already in my mind knew that he didn't, because the first GTS that he hit in WWE was at the San Jose show that I was at the night after this tournament took place. But they had me believing that he was going to hit it. It was actually the second time in this match that he had teased the GTS. And if you tease something a second time, normally you follow through with it. So Balor was on the top rope. Itami got him on his shoulders from the top rope. He took him off the top rope, put him on his shoulders, walked to the center of the ring with him, and he actually did the motion. I mean, he did the move, but instead of hitting the knee, Balor rolled him up for a near fall, and then Itami caught him with the running kick to the face for the pin. After the match, the two shook hands. They embraced in the middle of the ring, and Itami pointed at the WrestleMania sign that was hanging from the ceiling of the convention center. Adapting quickly to the WWE style, I see. He has mastered his pointing technique. He will go far. They showed Itami coming through the curtain when he went backstage. And who is the first person that you see standing there when Hideo Itami walks through the curtain into the gorilla position? I swear to God, Hillbilly Jim. Hillbilly Jim. He's just standing there. I mean, I guess he was there for one of the signing sessions at Access. But there he was, and then there's Tatsumi Fujinami standing there next to Triple H. So you have Hideo Itami, Tatsumi Fujinami, and Hillbilly Jim together in the same scene. I didn't think the show could get any better, but it did. They then aired a video package on the San Jose State show that I attended. Probably the closest thing you're going to get to seeing it on the network, unfortunately. I got to tell you, I'm watching the highlights of this thing, and I'm so happy. I'm so happy I got to be there for that show. I'm sorry to gloat, but I really wish you guys could have been there. It was that much fun. They did kind of, sort of air the GTS that Itami gave to Breeze. I think that was later on in the mini-documentary that they aired here at the end of this episode. I don't know if it was actually this part here, but they aired it. But they cut away quickly, almost like they didn't want to show too much because they would rather save it for a big takeover match or something, or maybe when and if he wins the championship at some point. But the place exploded when he hit it. I put the video up on my Twitter. They even showed all the tweets all over the screen of people marking out over the GTS. I couldn't tell if my tweet was in there anywhere. We got a preview for next week's show that will have Sami Zayn back in action finally. He'll be going one-on-one with Rhino. Then we get to the documentary stuff. And as good as all the stuff was up until this point, the matches were very good. This is what made the episode for me and made it one of, if not my favorite NXT episode that I've watched. And I've been watching this show now probably over two years, and this was the best. They had a camera follow Hideo Itami around for the duration of his WrestleMania weekend. First, they aired clips of his debut. I mean, they went all the way back. This was like something out of a Hideo Itami DVD that they will maybe make at some point in the future. They aired clips of the debut show in Japan where Hulk Hogan was there to introduce him to the company and he signed his contract. Hogan even admitted the go-to-sleep was his move, not Hogan's move. Actually, that'd be kind of funny if Hogan tried to claim that the GTS was his own move. Now, he said it was Kenta's move. He called him Kenta. It was Kenta's move. He was the one who innovated it. So they admitted that here on the show. They showed his two kids. He has two small boys and his wife, all of whom were in town for WrestleMania. And that's when it hits you. This guy, who was already one of the biggest stars in Japan, making a good living for himself, a wife, two small kids, because he so badly wanted to pursue his dream to see if he can make it in WWE, just to see if he could do it. He left all of that behind, including his family. He left them thousands of miles away in Japan to come to the United States and live in a tiny apartment in Orlando to start from the bottom like a rookie and work his way up. Gave up a ton of money, gave up his name, his whole identity, everything, just for the chance to make it here. Two young sons that he never gets to see. I didn't even know that he had kids. That's a pretty incredible story, I think. My favorite part of the whole thing was after they showed him nailing Breeze with the GTS at the San Jose State show, his two kids are backstage, they're going gaga over it, and one of his sons gets the younger kid on his shoulders for the GTS as well. That was cool. And just like their father, they only teased it. They didn't actually follow through with it. So following in daddy's footsteps, I see. I also liked that they showed Tyler Breeze on a PS4, just sitting on a couch playing a game with Sasha Banks, and Itami and his kids are standing behind the couch. They're standing behind them. And he tells his older son, go ahead and poke him. And the older son pokes Breeze in the arm. And then Breeze turns around and just smiles. You know, killing kayfabe, yes, but I thought it was cute. So this was all great. I mean, just, you know, they showed other footage of Itami kind of just walking around. He got the backpack on. He looks like a tourist. He's got a backpack on his back. He's looking around. He's just happy to be there. That's what he kept repeating. I'm so happy. I'm so happy. And I'm sure he was. I mean, I'm sure he was on fucking cloud nine that whole weekend, especially when he knew he was actually going to be on the show. And so they get to the WrestleMania stuff. He's in the stadium hours before the show, just looking around, taking it all in. You know, they made it sound like he's never competed in front of that big of a crowd before, which isn't true. I mean, technically, I guess it is true. But he has competed in Japan, like at the Tokyo Dome, I think, in some big shows in front of 50,000 people. So it's not like he's only ever performed in front of 500 people or 1,000 people in his career. But this was the biggest crowd he has ever performed in front of. And this big open outdoor stadium, and he's just taking it all in. Dean Ambrose comes over, they're talking for a little bit. They show him backstage talking to Seth Rollins. Rollins is joking, man, it took me 3 years to get here. It took you 6 months. So they're kind of shooting the shit backstage, and he's getting ready for the Battle Royal. And They show him walking to the ring. It's such a weird thing because they show him backstage at WrestleMania in the gorilla position before they go out for the Battle Royal. And it's just him and a bunch of mid-card guys. It's like him and you see, you know, there's Goldust and there's fucking Heath Slater and Zack Ryder. And it's like, I know this guy is like a WWE rookie, but this guy, he's better than this. He doesn't belong with these guys. So they all go out to the ring for the Battle Royal, and they showed him eliminating Bo Dallas, and then they showed him getting tossed by the Big Show like a nobody, and then he makes the walk to the back, and one of the more emotional parts of the whole thing was as he's going through the tunnel to return to the backstage area, just as he gets in the tunnel, so he's not really in the back yet, but he's kind of out of the view of the crowd, he crouches down on his knees, and it looks like he's crying. He's just so happy. I mean, yeah, he got punched in the face and eliminated. But for him, it was a big moment. He got to wrestle his first match at WrestleMania, 75,000 people. And here's this guy, as big of a name as he was in Japan, as much success and championships and everything that he's had. He has his moment. He gets to the back and just crouches down in the corner and starts crying. I mean, that's for him, that's a big moment. You know, that's a big moment for him. They show the New Day coming back and congratulating him and Daniel Bryan, Mark Henry, even the Big Show. Big Show goes over to him and like hugs him and says, "It was an honor to work with you. I hope we get to work together a lot more often." There was one really dumb comment that Triple H made at the end of this whole thing. And I know what he meant by it, but it was still stupid. So after a Tommy lost, Triple H says Hideo actually won in every way imaginable. He won in every way imaginable, Triple H said. I just shook my head when I heard that. Because they honestly believe that. That's the whole thing. You know, like I can see if he goes out there, gets a big reaction, blows everybody away in the back, including Vince McMahon, and then has this great performance before he loses. You can say, hey, he lost, but he really won because he made this huge impression. He gained so much by being out there and doing what he did. Do you really think that Hideo Itami made any sort of impression on Vince McMahon by spending 5 minutes in the Battle Royal and getting knocked out like an undercard guy? Does anyone honestly believe this made any sort of meaningful impression on Vince McMahon? He's the guy running the show. He's really the only one that matters. We know Triple H is well aware of Hideo Itami, who he is, where he comes from, and what he's capable of. But it doesn't matter what Triple H thinks in this case. It's what Vince McMahon thinks. So I ask you again, do you honestly believe that what Itami did out there made any sort of meaningful impression on Vince McMahon? I mean, I don't think so. He wasn't out there long enough to really make that much of an impression. You're in there with 29 other guys. It wasn't like a singles match or an eight-man tag or something like that. They didn't really give him anything. And, you know, Hideo won in every way imaginable. I mean, no, he didn't. What a stupid thing to say. But, you know, Triple H, I was talking about this with a friend, actually, last night. We were having a conversation about this. You know, Triple H has got to be in a weird position. It's not like, oh, woe is Triple H. I mean, Triple H, believe me, he married well, and he's in a very good position. He's got a very nice life for himself. But he's got to be in this weird position where you know he cares a lot about NXT. And he cares a lot about those guys down there. And he's got his little clique of top guys like Neville and Zayn and Owens and Balor. And Itami is part of that. Samoa Joe may soon be part of that. And I really do think he cares. And he wants to see these guys succeed. And even if just for selfish reasons, and I don't think it's just selfish. I really think he wants to see these guys do well and carry the company. But selfishly, I'm sure, part of it also is it reflects poorly on Triple H if these guys make it to the main roster and they don't do anything, or they flop, as some have. I can name a few different people who have gone to the main roster and have flopped for various reasons, male and female. And I think Triple H knows that that doesn't reflect well on him. No matter what's going on at any given moment at NXT, oh, this is great, this is the future. Once they make it to the big leagues, as Michael Cole, I think Michael Cole made that comment in the Battle Royal. Welcome to the big leagues, kid, you fucking moron. But as these guys graduate to that next level, if they don't succeed, it reflects poorly on Triple H. So selfishly, I'm sure he has every reason to want to see these guys do well. And it's got to just kill him when he's back there and he's part of the creative process and he's in the production meetings and he hears what the plans are for some of these guys. Like, he probably even heard what the plan was for Itami. If it were up to Triple H, I'm sure Hideo Itami was not getting dumped out and knocked out by Big Show in 5 minutes. I refuse to believe that Triple H had any sort of real input into what happened with Itami in that Battle Royal. It probably killed him to see that. He probably watched that and went, fuck, like, what is wrong with you? You old senile man. I'm sure there's thoughts like that that are going through his head. I mean, there are people who think that Triple H, if it were up to him, he wouldn't promote any of these guys to the main roster. I don't think he does want to lose any of them. I know on these conference calls that he does before the TakeOver specials that Triple H does, you know, he has made comments before about how, no, I want them to. I want, you know, somebody from, you know, the main roster to call me up and say, hey, or Vince to call me up and say, hey, we need this guy. So even if the guy is in the middle of like a big storyline on NXT, I want that because it keeps us on our toes, because now we got to find somebody else to fill the void. Jim Cornette used to, you know, bitch about that all the time when he was in charge of booking in OVW, and he had a lot of storylines going on with different guys. They would call and they would take them away from him. And so now he would have to scramble and find somebody new to plug in there or come up with a completely different storyline. There were loose ends that weren't tied up. I'm sure it's frustrating if you're a booker for that to happen. But as a developmental promotion, I mean, that's what the whole purpose of that is, right? And so when the main roster comes calling and they need you, you got to go. And there are people who think that Triple H, if it were up to him, you know, he wouldn't send any of those guys to the main roster. He doesn't want to see them go there because he knows probably what will end up happening. And I believe that. I think on some level there's a lot of truth to that. So he could say whatever he wants to publicly on these conference calls, but I don't really think he believes that. I really don't think deep down he believes that. And who can blame him? The way some of these guys are treated, I mean, Neville so far, so good, but he's only been on TV for 2 weeks. We'll see what happens. I still think his size and the big ears and the accent, they're all going to work against him. With Kevin Dunn, and who doesn't like people with funny accents, and Vince McMahon, I mean, those sorts of things are going to be a struggle. They're going to be tough to overcome. I think less so if Triple H was in charge, because he sees the talent that these guys have, but what can he do? He has not yet ascended to the throne. At some point, he probably will, but he hasn't yet. And I'm sure it kills him on some level when that sort of thing happens. Kevin Owens sent out a tweet saying, after the show went off the air, saying, "The footage of Hideo Itami's path to WrestleMania on tonight's NXT episode was so inspiring, too bad I'll have to take him out one day. And after watching this show, I know it would make more sense to have Sami Zayn be the one to beat Kevin Owens and take back his title, but I would love for it to be Hideo Itami getting the championship with the GTS on Kevin Owens. What a great story that would be. And then Owens can move up to the main roster," which is funny after what we just talked about. Although I think Kevin Owens is a guy, when he gets the call up, I think he'll be okay. Kevin Owens is one of those like special guys. He's just different. He's got something about him. He's got an aura about him in the way he carries himself and his promos and everything, where even if they try to fuck him up somehow, I think Kevin Owens will be okay. Sami Zayn is another one. I think no matter how hard they may try to fuck him up, he'll be okay too. But, you know, Owens can move up to the main roster, let's say, if Itami beats him for the championship. Owens and Zayn can go up. And Itami can defend the title against Joe or something, you know, on NXT. I would love to see that. That's not the only great tweet, by the way, that Kevin Owens sent out this week. I will save that for this week's sad tweet segment that you will not want to miss at the end of this week's show. But anyway, I got to say, I'm even more pumped after this week's episode of NXT. I'm even more pumped now for that E60 special on NXT that ESPN is airing next month. Don't forget, May 5th, Cinco de Mayo. Mark it down in your calendars or your DVR. That is going to be an episode you will not want to miss. ProWrestlingTees.com is your one-stop shop for all things Sound Off. We've got a ton of different t-shirt designs up there right now, including the official Sound Off logo shirt, the Eat Sleep Sound Off repeat shirt, and original designs as well, like Let Me School You, Son, and It's Not Rocket Science, People. And it's not rocket science that you should go right now to our store, ProWrestlingTees.com/SolomonsterSoundsOff, and get yourself a shirt, maybe two. They ship all over the world, so if you are an international fan of the show, fear not, you can get your own Sound Off shirt. You can also pay via credit card or PayPal, whatever works best for you. So head on over to ProWrestlingTees.com/SolomonsterSoundsOff. Buy yourself a Sound Off shirt. The next time you go to Monday Night Raw, TNA, Ring of Honor, or just out with the family, you can represent the Sound Off with an official Sound Off t-shirt. Again, visit ProWrestlingTees.com/SolomonsterSoundsOff and get your shirt right now. I did not have time to watch Impact this week, so we are going to have to skip the Impact review, but I did get to see this week's Lucha Underground. So let's get into it here. The show opened with Dario Cueto meeting with Prince Puma and Conan in his office. He wants the Trios tag team titles that they are introducing to mean as much as Puma's Lucha Underground championship. So a promoter wanting his titles to actually mean something. What is this sorcery here that I'm hearing? He tells Puma, even though you're the champion, you're in the Trios tournament. You got to find two partners because your match is next week. And they will be facing King Cuerno and two partners that would be announced later in the show. But tonight, on this episode, Prince Puma will go one-on-one with King Cuerno for the Lucha Underground Championship. That's our main event. We had Ivelisse, Son of Havoc, and Angelico against Drago, Aerostar, and Phoenix in the Trios Tag Team Tournament. This match was pure insanity from bell to bell. And the crowd ate it up the whole time. This was great. Honestly, I think the show peaked with this match because nothing else on the show could touch it. It was the best thing on the entire show. Ivelisse, Son of Havoc, and Angelico were unwilling partners from the get-go. And near the end, when Son of Havoc, who is insanely over with the crowd in that temple, as they call it, he went for a tag and Ivelisse dropped off the apron and deserted him. And the crowd booed. But Son of Havoc ended up winning the match anyway for his team with the Shooting Star Press, so they must remain an unwilling team as they move on to the finals? Is it the finals already? I think so. Unless there's another round before, but either way, they're moving on. Drago and Aerostar, they ended up having problems on their own. They still have one match left in their Best of Five series, so the tension is building there. That was obviously Dario Cueto's plan all along when he booked them in a best of five series together, these two friends, was to drive a wedge between them, and it appears to be working. To the back, where Prince Puma is doing pull-ups when Conan walks in to let him know, not to worry, I've gone and gotten Hernandez as one of your partners for next week's six-man tag in the Trios match. Puma doesn't speak, by the way. Their champion is a mute, because if he spoke, it would expose the fact that he is not, in fact, a luchador, but rather a black dude from Illinois. Would kind of kill the gimmick, I think. Johnny Mundo came into camera shot and said that he would be Puma's other partner, which did not make Conan very happy at all, since Conan, if you remember, previously he has warned Prince Puma that Johnny Mundo is not to be trusted and you need to stay the hell away from him. But that didn't stop Puma and Mundo from doing the cheesiest handshake that I have seen probably since Dutch and Dylan in Predator. I have not seen that movie in ages, but there have been some cheesy 1980s action flick handshakes, okay? This is way up there with them. You gotta find a fucking gif of this or something. Dario Cueto then made a mask versus mask match between Superfly and Sexy Star. Now, if you remember the week before, Sexy Star had saved Superfly from getting his arm broken by Pentagon Jr. Sexy Star and Superfly are friends. So Dario made the match between them, and then before the match started, he came out of his office and said, oh, by the way, it's mask versus mask. As his way of making sure, okay, you guys aren't going to lollygag around and get out of it because you don't want to fight each other. The mask in Lucha Libre means so much to one's identity that I'm going to make this a mask match so that you guys go out there and beat the fuck out of each other. That was his idea. The announcers, they tried to get over what a big deal the mask is, but this match, it just came out of nowhere. The stipulation, it just came out of nowhere. No build-up, no nothing. So it didn't really have, I think, the time to build that it really needed. And if somebody loses a mask, I think it should be the main event, not in the middle of the show. But that's just me. That aside, I have to say, I was not really a fan of this match at all. Now, we've seen a lot of intergender matches on Lucha Underground. We had one at the beginning of the show. Ivelisse was in there, and she was, you know, hanging with the guys. But Ivelisse was in there to do a few spots. She did a dive at one point off the top rope. This was different. This was a one-on-one match, and Superfly is fighting for the right to keep his mask, and he was beating the shit out of her. He was slapping her, he was smacking her in the face, he was kicking her in the ribs. And, you know, obviously it's fake, it's entertainment and all that kind of stuff, but I think I made this comment very early on when I started watching Lucha Underground, that it was tough for me to get into the whole male versus female thing, and part of it is the believability of it as well. I know the idea is to build sexy stars, she's as tough as the men, but you know what? She's not. When it comes to physical, I'm not saying her fighting spirit isn't there, but it's just too unrealistic. And I just don't like the idea of having a guy in there beating the fuck out of a woman. I just, you know, it's one thing to do a move or two here or there, but this guy was just, you know, smacking and slapping the shit out of her. And it just took me out of the... It's my personal preference. It just doesn't work for me. It took me out of the match. And the believability aspect took me out of the match. Superfly missed a top rope moonsault at the end. Sexy Star pinned him with an Oklahoma roll. Or a La Magistral cradle, whatever you prefer to call it. Maybe for the purposes of this show, La Magistral would be more appropriate. Superfly gets on his knees when the match is over. Tells Sexy, go ahead and unmask me. She's very hesitant to do it, but she knows she has to. She finally does it, and Superfly is unmasked. The second time that he has been unmasked in the last 4 months, as he lost a mask match with Aerostar down in Mexico in December. So thankfully, this was not the first big unmasking, because if it was, what a waste this would have been. In Mexico, what they usually do, they will tell you the person's name, the real name, and the real age of that person when they get unmasked. It's a whole big ceremony type thing when somebody gets unmasked down in Mexico. They didn't do any of that here. Pentagon Jr. ran out. He sent Sexy Star out to the floor so he could deliver a package pile driver to Superfly and break his arm, which he tried to do the week before Sexy made the save. So another arm added to the collection. People went crazy for Pentagon. I mean, why shouldn't they? The guy is awesome. The guy is fucking awesome. It's like Brock in WWE, right? When he comes out, you know that bad things are going to happen, and somebody's getting their ass kicked. I don't care how much of a heel you are, at some point, that stuff turns you babyface, and I think that's what we're seeing with Pentagon Jr. Main event was Prince Puma and King Cuerno for the Lucha Underground Championship. Prince Puma comes to the ring wearing a Puma head on his head to mock King Cuerno's deer head. He is, after all, the deer head man, as I call him. And I'm watching this, and all I could think is, oh boy, I hope PETA doesn't watch this show, or Brian Blade, for that matter. King Cuerno introduces Cage and Tejano as his partners for next week's Trios match, and they will also be in his corner, we find out, for the main event tonight, as Hernandez and Johnny Mundo are for Prince Puma. So everybody is out there. Not sure why Cuerno is getting a championship match before Johnny Mundo, since Johnny Mundo beat King Cuerno in a steel cage match only a few weeks ago. It doesn't make sense when WWE does it, and it doesn't make sense here either. Yet another reason that I advocate for a ranking system that people can follow. So a legitimate ranking system that means something that you can track on the website or the app at any given time. You know, you have a top 10 for your main championship, top 5 for everything else. I really think something like that would work, just to give things some more order. And if you want to reshuffle the deck and you want to move somebody, let's say, who's number 6 contender and make them, let them leapfrog everybody to number 3. So you have a match. You have a match between the number 3 guy and the number 6 guy. And if the number 6 guy beats the number 3 guy, then they swap. I mean, there's a zillion different ways you could go with it. But I think it would really work in WWE, and I think it would work here too. There was a great spot early where Puma dived out onto Cage and Tejano, but they caught him because he's so small. They caught him in midair, held him there for a second, and then threw him kind of into the air and into a neck breaker by King Cuerno on the floor. Johnny Mundo did a dive later in the match that looked cool as hell, but probably was one of the most reckless things I've ever seen before on a wrestling show. It's like he didn't even have a plan for how he was going to land, for where he was going to land. He just did a crazy dive and hoped for the best, and he landed on the back of his head. So that was pretty stupid. Puma ended up getting the win with the 630 splash off the top rope to retain the championship. He and Hernandez had a little bit of a kerfluffle, a dust-up at the end, where Puma made it very clear he didn't need or want Hernandez's help. And after the match, when Hernandez tried to raise Puma's arm, Puma pulled it away. I'm sure this will play into the trios match next week, some dissension in the ranks. And maybe Hernandez goes heel and destroys Puma. You know, maybe Conan turns on Prince Puma and goes with Hernandez as his guy. I feel like it's been building for a while now. You know, this week, the look on Conan's face when he realized Puma had clearly defied him and went against his advice and picked Johnny Mundo as one of his partners, it reminded me of the Paul Heyman turn on Brock Lesnar back in 2002. Heyman turned on Brock and went with Big Show. So why did he do that? He did it because Brock started to disregard Heyman's advice. The monster began to ignore, his manager's advice and started to make decisions on his own. And so Heyman fucked him over. Heyman saw the writing on the wall and said, this guy is self-aware. He's ignoring me. Soon he won't have any need for me. So fuck him. And he went with Big Show, and Big Show won the championship. We may see the same thing happen with Conan and Prince Puma. I'm not saying Hernandez is going to win the title, but I think in terms of the Conan-Puma relationship, I think we may be on our way to something similar. So that was Lucha Underground. Good episode. Not as good as it's been, I think, in the last few weeks, but I have very few complaints. Aside from the intergender match, I thought it was actually pretty good. If you have questions for the mailbag, you can email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from, and you can also submit MP3 audio attachments as a question if you would like. In fact, we have one this week from our good friend, Mr. Noah Mark.
Solomonster, it's me, Noah Mark, here a few weeks removed after our WrestleMania 31 adventure. And at the time, you had said that WrestleMania 30 was better than 31. You wanted to warm up to it. Now, a few weeks later, I'd like you to go a little bit more in depth. What do you think? WrestleMania 30 versus WrestleMania 31. I think WrestleMania 31, this past one, was better. Surprises, twists and turns, and plus low expectations yielded a pretty darn good WrestleMania, especially live in person. So barring any outside parameters, the city and the events surrounding the weekend, just the WrestleManias alone, what do you think?
Ah, I was hoping you would forget that and not make me go back and compare. But I did, and as a matter of fact, I brought up the two cards here for WrestleMania 30, just to refresh my memory, and WrestleMania 31. Just to jog my memory about the matches, just to make sure I didn't forget anything. And I think the two shows, in a lot of ways, are remarkably on par. I think they're almost neck and neck when I look at this Mania overall from top to bottom, 30 as compared to 31. But you know, I look at WrestleMania 30, and I'm reminded of the tag team match the last 2 years. The tag team title match has been relegated to the pre-show. And so both years, I was paying attention, but probably not paying close attention. And again, I was at both shows, and that might have been part of the reason, just getting to our, to our seats and getting prepared and whatever else. It's almost like the tag team match is on in the background, even though I'm in the building. But I remember last year's match being a little bit better, and I checked, and it was actually a lot longer. I didn't think it was that much longer, but the tag team match was a fatal four-way last year at WrestleMania, again involving the Usos, and that match went 16 minutes. The tag team match this year went not even 10 minutes, so they didn't give him as much time, although both were fatal four-ways. But I think the tag match was better last year. The Battle Royal this year just angered me. It really did. They gave it more time, but it just pissed me off. And they did the Mizdow Miz turn finally, which was inevitable. It was going to come no matter what. But then they just completely crapped the bed. I mean, forget the whole Hideo Itami thing that we talked about earlier. There was no reason for Damian Mizdow not to win that match and use that as a way to further the storyline and lead to the eventual first singles match between him and Miz. And I just don't see the reason. I mean, other than the whole let me cross my arms and pose next to the trophy, goofy shit, there was no reason for the Big Show to win that match. So it wasn't just that I was upset at the finish, like my guy didn't win kind of thing. I just think it was bad booking. And just a complete waste. Whereas the Battle Royal last year, even though we look back on it now and we kind of laugh because look at what they squandered. Look at what they could have had with Cesaro and still could have. And look how they fucked it up. But at the time, we didn't know that, right? So as a self-contained Battle Royal, I look back and it was a Battle Royal. All these Battle Royals are the same. It's just a bunch of guys in there, You're just waiting for it to come down to the final two. There's not a whole lot going on. But when it came down to Big Show and Cesaro last year, I loved what they did. And Cesaro, not just eliminating the Big Show, but picking him up, holding him there, like in the body slam position. And the entire building, the entire Superdome going crazy. Like this hot Andre Hogan moment for a second there. And then dumping out the Big Show and Big Show shaking hands with Cesaro as a show of respect when the match is over. I loved it. I thought it was great. I remember the finish of that Battle Royal caught me by surprise, and it was the right move to make. Because at that time, they thought this is going to be a guy that we're going to push. This is a guy that we're going to bank a lot on. We're going to push him to the moon, and we're going to see how far we can go with him. And they put him with Heyman the next night, and everybody was so bullish and happy on what the future had, you know, in store for this guy. And then they just completely crapped the bed on it. But I think the Battle Royal and the Battle Royal outcome last year was just light years ahead of what they did this year. And then as far as the rest of the card, you know, last year's WrestleMania is hard to top. I mean, they opened with Hogan. He was the host. And so hearing Real American again at WrestleMania for me was a cool moment. But then out comes Steve Austin, who we don't get to see very often. And out comes The Rock. And it was all a surprise. We didn't know in advance that they were going to have all these guys in the ring together at the same time. Three of the biggest stars, if not the three biggest stars in the history of this company in the ring together at the same time. That's pretty cool. I mean, to me, that is the best opening segment that they've ever had at WrestleMania. And so that was a great way to start the show. And then right from there, you go to Triple H and Daniel Bryan, who went out there and had a great 25-minute match. I mean, I think I like Bret and Owen better, but Triple H and Bryan are up there as maybe the second best opening match in the history of WrestleMania. Some might say the first. I wouldn't, but it was a damn good match. And that was the opener. Triple H was curtain jerking at WrestleMania last year. Think about that. And Daniel Bryan got the win, and they told the story, of course, with the arm injury. Triple H took out his arm when the match was over. The Shield had a real... I mean, the Shield's match last year was just a complete throwaway match. Those guys were just utterly wasted. But you had John Cena, Bray Wyatt, not the outcome that I think it should have been. But they had, you know, a good enough match. I would say, you know, comparable to Cena and Rusev this year in terms of it was just a match in the mid-card for John Cena. This year it happened to be for the championship. It had a story that was building, you know, Bray Wyatt was getting a push leading up to that match with Cena last year. Rusev maybe was getting a bigger push because he was unbeaten. He had a belt. But it's almost like a wash in a way, right? It's just a mid-card John Cena match that in the end he wins. I don't think one match was dramatically better than the other. Last year was Brock Lesnar beating The Undertaker and ending the streak at WrestleMania. This year was Undertaker and Bray Wyatt, which was just a match. That's all it was. There was nothing on the line. There was no titles. There was no streak. There was no retirement. There was nothing. In fact, Undertaker never made a single appearance on television to even build up the match. He went out there. He looked 1,000 times better than he did last year. Last year was one of the worst Undertaker WrestleMania matches of the decade. I can't say it was worse than any of those matches like with Giant Gonzalez back in the day and stuff, but Undertaker had built up this reputation in recent years as being the guy at WrestleMania, as a guy that was consistently having better matches year after year. Somehow, even though he was getting older and more broken down, he was having better matches. Then again, look at the caliber of the people he was in the ring with, i.e. Shawn Michaels, and it's not that surprising. But he had built up this reputation as a guy who delivered on the big stage. This was not the Undertaker who used to just fucking roll his eyes in the back of his head and choke people for 75% of the match. And last year he went out, maybe because of the concussion that he suffered. It was a pretty bad concussion. But he had a really crappy match, I thought. Just a boring, bad match with Brock Lesnar. But the finish changed everything. As far as like the historical value of that match, and as somebody who was in the building, I can tell you, I've never seen a crowd of people as shocked to have seen something as last year when the streak ended. Nobody saw it coming. And that will go down in the annals of time as one of the all-time great shocking moments in WrestleMania history. So like when Noah says, well, this year we had surprises and shocks with the cash-in at the end of the show and DX and the NWO coming out, that was a lot of fun, and I didn't see that coming. But, you know, it was just some stupid thing to do in the Triple H Sting match. It was a bunch of smoke and mirrors, and they had to come up with something to do. They built that whole stupid Monday Night Wars. Like, this was about the Monday Night Wars, which has been over for fucking 15 years. That was the story they told. It was cool to see it, but in terms of shock and awe, you can't beat the streak ending last year. You just can't. And a shocked Undertaker guy in the crowd, and me laughing in the crowd, which is always fun to go back and watch. So to me, as crappy as the match may have been, I mean, that you can't top that moment. I mean, that's just a huge moment that only happens maybe once or twice in the lifetime of being a wrestling fan. And then you have the women's match. This year it was a tag team match. They gave them 6 minutes. Last year it was a women's gauntlet with AJ Lee as well. That also went 6 minutes. And both years, AJ won, actually. I think with her move, yeah. 2 years in a row she won with the Black Widow. So to me, the women's matches, they wash one another out. It's a wash. It's not like 1 year was better than the other. Last year maybe it was worse, if only because the people were still so stunned by what they had just seen in the Undertaker match that they just didn't give a shit about the women. Even though, like, the whole women's roster was out there, nobody cared. But as far as the matches, both were pretty insignificant. At least last year, the championship was on the line. This year, they did a fucking tag team match. And then Daniel Bryan. I mean, last year was the Daniel Bryan story. It was the Daniel Bryan WrestleMania. So if you weren't a Bryan fan, you probably hated that show. But the story they told was a great one. And the fans helped, you know, get him into that main event of WrestleMania, change the main event. It turned out to be an excellent match. And I'm not normally a fan of doing a multi-man match at WrestleMania as the main event, which now we've ironically had 2 years in a row. Since this year, technically, it turned into a triple threat match. But I thought Bryan, Orton, and Batista had just a great match last year with a great finish. It was the right finish. It was a predictable finish, but it was the right one. And the place went nuts, and it told this great story. Daniel Bryan realizing his dream. He's got two belts. He's posing in the pyro and everything going off. It was great. And I love this year's WrestleMania main event, too. But it was a different kind of match. They did the cash-in at the end. Again, a surprising moment. I'm not hating on this year's WrestleMania at all. I actually thought it was a damn good show. But if you made me choose which overall top to bottom was the better, more enjoyable WrestleMania just from the matches and the angles and the storyline, it's WrestleMania 30. I still think WrestleMania last year is probably the best top to bottom WrestleMania show they've done in a decade. I really do. And maybe that's more of an indictment on WrestleMania in recent years. Or maybe it's just a sign that last year's show was pretty damn good. And I would say this year's show was probably right behind it. But if I had to choose, I would go 30 over 31. This comes from AJC. What is your take on the rumor about talent backstage in WWE being angry at the fans about Roman Reigns? Because this is one of those times, I really want this to be a false article. If it is true, what does that say about what they think about Seth Rollins? I don't think it says anything about what they think about Seth Rollins. Their issue is not with Seth Rollins. The issue, and apparently it's true, there is discontent in the WWE locker room. I think it was first reported in The Observer, who, you know, they certainly do talk to a lot of the talent in that company, especially some of the, like, the mid-card guys, so they would know. They're very upset at the fans, because the fans basically, you know, fucked up Roman Reigns' big moment at WrestleMania. And to that I say, boo fucking who? I have no beef at all with Roman Reigns. I said it earlier, I like Roman Reigns, and I think he gets shitted on and hated way too much. He's good, he's going to be the next big star, whether you like it or not, unless Vince just completely falls out of love with the guy, so you better get used to it. He's not nearly as bad as some people would make him out to be. But he was not the right guy for that spot at WrestleMania this year. If they brought back Daniel Bryan when they did, they should have had him win the Rumble. And even if not, Daniel Bryan's story would have made for a better story at WrestleMania. And I would have had no problem at all doing it the exact same way they did it. Maybe give Bryan a little more offense and not have him just be beaten to shit for 15 minutes like Roman Reigns. He just kept getting beaten down and beaten down, and he would laugh at Brock Lesnar and smile at him, and he had a little flurry of offense at the end, but it was a very one-sided match. It was not nearly as competitive as I thought it would be. And Bryan's a smaller guy than Roman Reigns, so if anything, you would think, man, this guy doesn't stand a chance, but I've said this before. The match that Punk and Lesnar had at SummerSlam a couple of years ago was the match of the year. It was fucking great. There's no reason that you couldn't send Bryan out there with Brock at Mania and have a similar kind of back-and-forth match. And you could do the exact same thing at the end. Have Rollins run out there and cash in. Perfectly fine with that. It would have made, though, for a better match, and it would have made for a better story going into WrestleMania, and it wouldn't have fucked up their plans as much, in that you wouldn't have people cheering, 100% or 95% of the people cheering for Brock Lesnar. I think if you had a likable babyface that people wanted to get behind, it would have been a lot easier to push this guy is the babyface and Brock is the heel. But you went against the grain. You chose an inferior opponent for what was available to you. And that's the end result. I'm not saying that every single year, whoever the fans cheer for, they have to be in the WrestleMania main event. It would have made for a better story. So they went with the inferior choice. They ended up having a really... I liked the match a lot. I really did. I liked the match a lot and the cash-in and everything. I mean, Roman, it's not like Roman went in there and stunk out the joint. He didn't do much. He was more of a ragdoll for Brock Lesnar than anything else. And then he did his little Superman punch in the spear. But he played his role fine. But this notion that, you know, a lot of the wrestlers are upset at the fans because they somehow fucked over Roman Reigns. How about you point the finger at your boss? How about that? Because if your boss had enough sense, that's not the match you would have booked in the first place. And Roman would still be on the ascent. He'd probably still have the fan support he had before all this shit even started. You just give him a little more time to grow and to get better. And maybe this time next year, he's the one challenging in the main event of WrestleMania, and he's getting cheered by everybody. But nope, this is going to be our guy. We need our one guy. He's the guy, and he's going to WrestleMania. And everybody else be damned. We don't care what you want. So, you know what? Point the finger at Vince McMahon. He's the one who made the choice. He's the one who made the choice. And at least he had enough sense to change plans, because the plan was always for Roman to win the belt. I believe that, 100%. But they changed plans. Rollins apparently didn't even know that he was going to be cashing in until like an hour before it happened. Brock knew, Roman probably knew, but Rollins didn't. But it was the right choice to make. But this notion that, well, fuck the fans, these idiots, that Roman's such a good guy, he doesn't deserve this. I agree, Roman doesn't deserve a lot of the hate that he's getting. But, you know, it's just sour grapes, you know. Go poo-poo to your boss. You want to point fingers, don't point the finger at the fans, point at your boss. Because you should have been smart enough to realize what was going to happen. But I don't think it has anything to do with, his colleagues or co-workers showing disrespect to Seth Rollins. I think they probably like Seth Rollins a lot, you know, and they recognize that he's probably the, I don't say the most, but like one of the most talented guys on that roster. And I don't think it's any issue they have with him. It's just the way that Roman has been treated by the fans. Is it over the top? Yeah, probably a little bit, but point the finger at your boss. Of course, none of them have the fucking balls to do that. They're fucking scared shitless. They don't want to lose their jobs. They don't want to rock the boat. They don't want to speak out. So if you don't have the fucking balls to do it, then tough shit. Blaming the fans is kind of silly to me. Dennis, in Chicago, my friend and I have been ramming our heads against the wall, trying to book Roman Reigns after his WrestleMania loss. Here's the idea that we came up with. What if we play the Samoan card? Turn both Roman Reigns and the Usos heel and have them come out and plow through some fuckers in honor of their family bloodline in an attempt to make Reigns look like the badass he once was. They could even bring in Samoa Joe to the main roster, or better yet, have Reigns do a few promos with The Rock. Would love to hear your thoughts on this idea. Well, first of all, for all the talk of Roman's promo ability maybe being his biggest weakness, your idea is to have him go toe-to-toe with one of the greatest promo guys in the history of the business. I'm sure Rock would like do all he can to help make him look good, but I don't know about that. But you know, I'm not sure doing with Roman on a smaller scale what WCW did with Sting in 1997 isn't the worst idea in the world. He doesn't have to rappel from the ceiling and not wrestle any matches for, you know, 18 months. But, you know, he was betrayed. If you remember back to the Sting storyline, he was betrayed by WCW. And here, you know, Roman feels betrayed as well. He was betrayed by his brother, the same brother that ended up screwing him out of his destiny at WrestleMania this year. The people have turned against him, even though the fans are now mostly cheering him. But let's put that aside for a second. Maybe he starts showing up to the shows sitting in the front row or standing in the shadows somewhere, pissed off, look on his face, street clothes. just watching and waiting, waiting for his chance to kill Seth Rollins, take down the entire Authority. And this goes on until he finally gets his title match. I feel like less is more with this guy. That's what works best with Roman Reigns. Less is more. You want to get him over, but not turn him heel? He doesn't speak and only strikes when he sees an opportunity to do so. And then he calmly walks away with, you know, like a swagger in his step. That's maybe how I would go about doing it. Now, if they want to turn him heel, I like your idea because it also solves the problem of what you do with the Usos, who I like, but they've grown kind of stale. Plus, I think, and some of this is what I've seen of him on Total Divas, but I think Jimmy Uso, especially, I don't know about Jay, but I think Jimmy, and I don't know why, I think he would excel as like this heel thug type. So, you know, Roman has some muscle behind him. He's back now as part of a faction, which is where he did his best work. And the three of them would probably have some damn good six-man tag team matches like the Shield did back in the day. Now, you mentioned Samoa Joe. I expect him to debut first in NXT whenever that is. But there really is no reason at all that he can't debut on Raw and just totally bypass developmental. I mean, the idea of him even having to be in a... And I know they say, it's not developmental, it's a brand now. It's still developmental. There really is absolutely no reason for him to be in developmental. But they are trying to, you know, position it more as like the hot brand. So I could see them wanting Joe as the face of that brand. No reason for him to be there, though. And the perfect way to do it, if you wanted to move him right into the main roster and have him bypass NXT altogether, is through this John Cena Open Challenge gimmick that they're doing. He comes out, the place goes nuts, because even though he spent 10 years in Purgatory, a.k.a. TNA, I do think there would be enough people who would know who he is and would probably react very big to him walking out on stage. So he's cheered wildly like a babyface, especially against Cena. He has a competitive match with John Cena. But you want to establish him as a heel, right? Well, have the Usos wander down to the ring during the match, and the announcers are playing it up like, hey, what the hell are they doing here? They do something to distract Cena, or they strike Cena behind the referee's back. That leads to Joe winning the U.S. title, first night in. And then after the match, he joins this like gangland beatdown of John Cena, and they all embrace, they all shake hands, they all, you know, hug, whatever. Because they're family, right? It's in their blood. They're blood, man. And then he gets on the mic, Joe does, and he says that that's how you make a statement. Or maybe he says something to the effect of like, you know, family first or something like that, if you want to point to the whole family bloodline thing. Now you've got a full-on Samoan clan with a guy who we know can talk. Roman can still be the leader, but he doesn't have to speak as much. And the Usos are there to kind of round out the group. And if they want a female in there, you could put Tamina in there. I think people have forgotten about her. You know, Tamina's due back any day now from her knee injury. She's not quite China, but she's not exactly your average female either. I think she's tough enough or has that tough kind of look to her where I can see her laying in some blows on some guys, and that didn't really come out the right way, but I think you get my point. So that's the idea that I would push for. Jermaine from Charleston, South Carolina. I really enjoyed Seth Rollins' cash-in at WrestleMania this year. Got me thinking, what is your favorite Money in the Bank cash-in? It's a tie between Rollins this year and Edge's first cash-in against John Cena, and between the two, which do you think is better? Well, I'll answer the second question first. If I have to compare the two, it's the Rollins cash-in, and if for no other reason, because he did it at WrestleMania. Edge cashed in on Cena at, New Year's Revolution or some random B-show like that. Seth Rollins cashed in the main event of WrestleMania in front of 75,000 people. So I think that gets the edge. No pun intended. Now, as far as my favorite Money in the Bank cash-ins, I was giving this some thought when I got the question. Dolph Ziggler's cash-in in New Jersey the night after WrestleMania 29, I believe it was, that's still my favorite. And maybe I'm a little bit biased because I was in the building that night, but even if you watched it on television, I mean, the crowd was just insane. Absolutely insane. From the moment his music hit, he walked out there with AJ and Big E, And he had the little mini match with Del Rio. They had some great near falls in that match, too, because when Ziggler came out, you know, it wasn't like a quick one-and-done 30-second kind of cash-in either. Del Rio had like a bum knee. He came out to take advantage of that. He beat him down. He immediately gave him a Famaster. And then Del Rio kicked out. And then I think Dolph tried something maybe in the corner, and he missed and got kicked in the head, whatever happened. And then people thought Del Rio's going to pin him. I did. Del Rio would beat Ziggler every single time they were in the ring together. And the way they were treating Ziggler and booking him at the time, it wouldn't have been shocking at all for that to happen. So then Ziggler kicked out. People were going crazy. And then Del Rio locked him in the arm bar, in the cross arm breaker. And I thought that was it. I said, I don't believe this. This guy's been carrying around this briefcase for months. He's in the hold. He's always tapped out to it. Everybody tapped out to it. He's going to tap out. But he didn't tap out. He kind of grabbed Del Rio's bum ankle, and he kind of cranked it, got out of the move, hit the zigzag, and the place just came unglued. It was great. It was just a great, even AJ was like crying, and she was hugging him when the match was over. Big E looked, he had this big shit-eating grin on his face, because they're all friends, and I'm sure they felt legitimately happy for the guy. This was the biggest moment of his career. Even to this day, I would say the biggest moment of Dolph Ziggler's career was that Money in the Bank cash-in and winning the championship the night after WrestleMania. Even bigger than beating John Cena in that ladder match at TLC in the main event on a pay-per-view. I still don't think it was as big as this moment was for him. I think that's where his career peaked. I'm sorry to say. At least so far. So that cash-in to me, it's hard to top that one. That's my favorite one. I would say my second favorite one, if I had to like rank them, I think the Rollins one at WrestleMania this year probably is number two. I just think it was so well done. You know, the crowd reaction is a big part of it, man. I mean, if these guys come out there to do this and the crowd is sitting on their hands, it hurts. You know, it hurts the enjoyment of the whole thing. But the crowd was shocked. Some people weren't shocked. They were happy. They were cheering. And it's the main event of WrestleMania. They actually found something to do here that we had not yet seen. We had never even seen an attempt at a cash-in at WrestleMania. When Ziggler lost, it was Ziggler and Big E against Daniel Bryan and Kane at WrestleMania 29. Just a throwaway match. And Bryan and Kane won. I thought for sure, okay, we haven't had the World Heavyweight title match yet, and they did this match, and of course Ziggler fucking lost, like he always did. So that must mean he's coming out after the match between Del Rio and Swagger. And yes, believe it or not, that was a championship match at WrestleMania. And he's going to cash in. Ziggler is going to become the first person ever to cash in at WrestleMania, and he didn't do it. And I remember being like, you got to be kidding me. What a wasted opportunity. Now, they did it the night after, but we have never seen anybody even attempt to cash in at WrestleMania. And so Rollins did, and he won, and it was a great moment. And so I'd probably put that at number two. And if I had to put a number three on my list, and this may surprise some people, I'm going to go with The Miz. Believe it or not, I'm going to go with The Miz's cash-in on Randy Orton in 2010. If for no other reason, strictly for that little girl's reaction after Miz won the championship. Angry Miz Girl. Angry Miz Girl was born. I got to go back and watch that. She was so pissed when The Miz won that match. But it was great. And the cash-in itself wasn't bad either. They had a little match. Orton had just wrestled. He had just beaten Wade Barrett. His knee or his ankle or something was wrecked. And then Miz came out. They had a match. Miz won. Fair and square. Skull-crushing finale. And boy, that girl, if she could burn a hole through the Miz's heart, she would have done that. So I would put that as my top three as far as Money in the Bank cash-ins. We have Mike from Long Island, New York. Whenever I hear people talk about the faces of WWE, they always mention Hogan, Austin, Rock, and Cena. Wasn't Bret Hart the face of the WWE when Hogan left? The only time I remember Rock being the face of the company was in 2000, and that was only for a year. I wasn't alive at the time, but when I watched the pay-per-views during that era, Bret was obviously the face of the company, so why is he left out of the mix while Rock was only the face for a year? Only as a substitute until Steve Austin came back. Well, this goes to the whole thing about the whole face of the WWE garbage. I mean, who gives a shit, right? Who gives a shit who the face of the company is? I mean, Rock, and I think also when you say it like that, you're really diminishing The Rock's role, even if you don't mean to say it that way. Because Rock, Yes, Rock became the de facto top babyface when Austin went down with a neck injury. And him and Triple H, they carried that company in 2000. That was Triple H's best year. 2000 into 2001, I would say even to this day, Triple H's best year in the business. As far as his in-ring work, the different programs and feuds, the actual quality of the matches that he was in, and his physical body and just what he was physically able to do. This was pre-quad tear. Because I really don't think he was ever really quite the same after that quad tear. And he got all muscled up and jacked up and, you know, whatever he's doing now. He's bigger now at fucking 43 years old than he's ever been. I mean, yeah, I'm sure that's totally natural. But anyway, so yeah, Rock and Triple H were carrying that company on their shoulders in 2000. And for a time, Rock was the face of the company. But I think when you talk about Hogan, Austin, Rock, Cena, why does everybody talk about them as the face of the company? I think you're talking about that Mount Rushmore question. That's really how this whole thing started. Like, who would you put on your Mount Rushmore of wrestling stars in WWE history, of top guys in WWE history? And you got to pick four faces, right? If you're basing it off Mount Rushmore. And so people pick the four faces they feel would be on, you know, on a Mount Rushmore, if you had one dedicated to the company. And that would be, and I think I've mentioned my own before. I think mine was mine Bruno? Did I include Bruno in mine? I think it was Bruno, Hogan, Austin, and Cena. Might have been my Mount Rushmore. But anyway, I think that's why you hear all this talk about the face of the company and why people would name those four. It's the whole Mount Rushmore thing. Brett absolutely was the face of that company. In fact, Brett was the entire face of the New Generation era. When Hogan left, and so this would have been, when did the New Generation stuff, was it in 94 or was it the end? I want to say it was actually in 94. So heading into WrestleMania 10, they started this campaign called the New Generation of WWE. And Bret Hart was inarguably positioned as the face of the New Generation era in WWE. And maybe Shawn Michaels to a lesser extent. Shawn became the face in 96 when he won the title. But absolutely, absolutely Bret Hart was the face of that company. And deserves to be in that conversation. If you're talking about who ever in the history of WWE at any point was the face of that company, there's a lot of guys we could throw in there, okay? Savage would be in that conversation. Because when Hogan left to go film a movie role and Savage had the championship, I mean, you could still say Hogan, I guess, was the face. But you could also argue Savage was. Savage had a damn good run, a very successful run as the champion in 88. Brett, sure. Shawn Michaels, sure. You know, didn't do gangbuster business. Although I do remember reading that actually house shows were very good when Shawn Michaels was the champion. Ratings, not so much. But was he ever the face of the company? Of course. Of course he was. And so was Brett. Brett even longer than Shawn, I would say. So does he deserve to be in the conversation? Absolutely. I mean, Brett, in that era, Brett was the fucking man. He went out there, he had matches with Owen and Davey Boy, and then they stuck him in that awful feud with Bob Backlund, and then Brett had some great matches with guys like Hakushi and Jean-Pierre Lafitte. Yeah, 95 was actually not a good year for WWE. Canadian Dynamite, Cole Bloxham in Lloydminster, Alberta, Canada. Did the Attitude Era hurt the wrestling business long term? I ask this because I recently heard Jim Cornette refer to the Attitude Era and the Monday Night War as hotshotting. According to Cornette, this means that during this time, both WCW and WWE were consistently playing the weekly game of topping each other. Cornette stated, long-term, this numbed the fans to all sorts of angles because they got so used to seeing certain things week after week, and it burned out the fan base. Do you agree with this characterization, or is Cornette exaggerating? No, I think he's right. And he was part of it. He lived it, so he would know, as good as anybody would. Absolutely. I think for all the good that came out of that period, is, you know, the big boom period in wrestling, and it made a lot of people a lot of money. It did a lot of long-term harm, absolutely. When WCW went under and there was no competition anymore and WWE didn't have to fight as hard as they did and didn't have to really kind of struggle creatively to come up with stuff so they could top what the other guys were doing on the other channel, they kind of, I think to some extent, they started resting on their laurels. I think even if they didn't realize it creatively, especially now, Just they're missing something. And competition, I'm sure, has a lot to do with that. But look at everything they did in that era, right? Every single week, one guy would jump ship from this brand to that brand. From WCW to WWE, from WWE to WCW. Who's going to jump next? That was the big question. And you had, you know, it was the NWO and DX, and they were kind of the cool heels, or I guess DX, you know, were baby faces. Top stars having matches, main event level, main event caliber matches on television every single week. They just gave it away for free. You had matches on television every single week that, if you just go back 2 or 3 years before that era, it would have, I mean, tell Vince McMahon, hey, listen, I'm going to give away a Steve Austin versus Rock match on Raw. He would look at you like you had a third eyeball in the middle of your skull. Like, you're not going to give away a match like that on TV. Look what fucking Eric Bischoff did. He gave away Goldberg and Hogan on Nitro in the Georgia Dome. And then 6 days later at the Bash at the Beach, Goldberg, your new WCW World Heavyweight Champion, wasn't even in the main event. He was second to last defending against freaking Kurt Hennig. I mean, they gave away matches like candy like that every single week because they were competing. They were competing for... It was all about ratings. I mean, you made your real money on pay-per-views, but they were blinded by this rat race when it came to the Nielsen numbers, and that became the most important thing in the world to them, and it still is. And they've completely killed off the pay-per-view business. Now it's all about the network, but it's about the network and it's about ratings because USA Network is paying them a fuck ton of money. And they got 3 hours of TV time to fill. They didn't even have that long in the Attitude Era. The Attitude Era, at least, you know, you look back, it wasn't all great, but, you know, it was a lot more fun. It was, you know, I would argue that you probably had a lot more entertaining stuff going on during that period. If anything, you'd want the extra hour then. I mean, now you get better wrestling. That is true. The wrestling now, the in-ring wrestling, is much better now than it was back then. So it's probably better off, you know, that you only had 2 hours of, you know, Mark Henry and Mae Young angles back in the day. But, yeah, everything was, you know, just throw it at a wall, and if it sticks, great. And if it doesn't, we'll try something else. I mean, everything, they put everything out there in that era and really just didn't give a second thought to 10, 15 years down the road. What is this going to mean? It's like all the ladder matches, right? When you see a ladder match for the very first time, it's a unique thing. You don't have to do a lot. But then you have a bunch of guys who come out and they try a bunch of crazy spots and it's like, well, how can we top that? So then they do something even crazier and then it becomes, well, how do we top that? Like Hell in a Cell, right? Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker had this fantastic Hell in a Cell match. And they did climb to the top and they did a little thing where Shawn fell off the side. It wasn't anything like overly crazy though. But then Mick Foley went out there and he threw his fucking ass off the top of the cage, not once, but twice. Then fell onto thumbtacks, as if that wasn't enough. And then I feel bad for whoever came after that, because it's like, what the fuck, man? Like, you know, what are you doing? Because now anything else is going to pale by comparison. So it's kind of the same thing, where you're constantly trying to top yourself. You're constantly trying to top everybody else. You give everything away. But now you're trying to put the genie back in the bottle. It doesn't work that way. It really doesn't work that way. That's why people watch the shows now, you know, most of the time, and they're yawning. I know I am. Because this is how it was, and now you're trying to go back to a time how it used to be, and it just doesn't work. So I think Cornette is right on the money when it comes to it. They hot-shotted everything back then. Everything was hot-shotted. Every single week, both shows, they hot-shotted stuff. Instead of what you would traditionally do, which is save it or build to something. So now they're trying to get back to that. They still hotshot stuff, absolutely. But it's not as bad as it was in like the late 90s. I mean, back then, all bets are off. I mean, you put your best, you know, all hands on deck. You put your best foot forward every single week on free television. That's what it was all about. John from California, after rewatching it on the WWE Network, who do you consider is the best trainer or host on Tough Enough? Stone Cold Steve Austin from Season 5 or Al Snow from Seasons 1, 2, and 3? Al Snow was also the host for Season 4 when it was the all-male version of the Diva Search on SmackDown in 2004. Well, those are two different things. Host and trainer are not the same thing. Austin was the host, not so much a trainer. And as a host, he kicked ass. I think he was the best. As a trainer on the show, I'd go with Al Snow. I thought Al Snow in that role was great. He was in that, he became this father figure, right, to a lot of the different guys on that show that Austin really wasn't. I mean, Austin was, it looked like he was kind of close with some of the people on the show, but Al Snow was like this father figure. And usually he was the nice one. He would leave it to like Taz or Bill DeMott to be the dick. I thought Al Snow, especially those first two seasons of Tough Enough, was just great. And they had Big John. Remember Big John? Now Big John's basically running TNA. You know, who knew? But they're just two totally different dynamics, two totally different roles. You really can't compare them. And John's second question is, I know King of the Ring 1993 is your favorite of them all, which it is. What is your second favorite King of the Ring event? 1998 is my second favorite. And finally here, Abdul from New Jersey. With Damian Sandow doing the big split from Miz, what do you think of Sandow picking up Macho Man's gimmick and becoming Macho Mandow and forming a comedy tag team of the Mega Powers with Curtis Axel? Macho Mandow. Well, I wouldn't call them the Mega Powers. You'd have to kind of tweak that name somehow, but I love that. I think that would be awesome. This week's sad tweet is actually more like sad tweets. Alex Riley, I mean, he's the gift that just keeps on giving. At Alex Riley, WWE, got into something of a little Twitter war with Kevin Owens. Anybody who follows Kevin Owens on Twitter knows that he is a very witty guy. He is very entertaining. And I would not want to go one-on-one with him in a Twitter war. Well, it started with a tweet that Alex Riley sent out. And, I can't even read it with a straight face. It's good to have goals in life, I guess. And it's good to be confident in your own abilities. But within reason. Alex Riley said, you want to turn that 1.3 into 2.6 at WWE Network? Give me a live mic and Kevin Owens. Now, what he was referring to is, they announced 1.3 million subscribers for the network. So what he's saying is, if you want to double the WWE Network number and have 2.6 million subscribers, look no further. All you got to do is give me a live microphone and put me in there with Kevin Owens. It's that simple, of course. Who knew? This whole time, the key to the success of the WWE Network was just Alex Riley. So Kevin Owens told him he's a fucking idiot. Not in those exact words, of course. And Alex Riley tweeted back at him, and then it just degenerated from there. Kevin Owens responded. Alex Riley had sent another tweet out to Kevin Owens saying, I'll see you in 10 years when I pull up to a mobile and you ask me if I want regular or unleaded. To which Kevin Owens responded, they're the same, you idiot. And then Kevin Owens is great. He said, I can't wait until you claim your Twitter was hacked once you realize all those tweets make you sound like an absolute dumbass. And then he said, I wish I could keep this going, but my phone battery's almost dead, much like Alex Riley's career. Ouch. This week's sad tweet honors, once again, bestowed upon Alex Riley. See, I think Alex Riley's problem is he rages too much, right? Talks about rage. Rage! It's too much rage. He's got to calm that down a little bit. He's starting to let all that rage go to his brain. You can tweet me your own suggestions for sad tweet of the week. Let me know. @Solomonster is my handle, and I may be able to use it on the show. I am only about 40 followers away, I think, last time I checked, from 10,000 on Twitter. Thank you to everybody who follows my ramblings on there. It's very cool that you do that. And if you're not already following me on Twitter, hey, maybe you'll be number 10,000. Just follow me, @Solomonster is my handle. I'll be live tweeting Monday night during Raw, as usual, so you can follow along with me during the show, no matter how good or bad it may be. Facebook.com/TheSolomonster is my profile page. We have a Facebook fan page that I would very much like you to, like if you haven't already done so. Just click the like button on there. And you can you can apply for membership to our Facebook discussion group. And if you are deemed worthy enough, I will approve you. We've got a nice community approaching 3,000 members. So be sure to get in on that. Again, the best way to support this podcast is to just keep spreading the word, keep letting people know about the Sound Off, maybe who've never heard it before. A lot of you guys were actually tweeting back at Wale. See, now I pronounce his name the correct way. Wale, I guess, was talking about wrestling podcasts that he listens to, like Austin Show and stuff like that, MLW. And a bunch of you guys tweeted at him to let him know about the Sound Off. So, I mean, who the hell knows if he'll listen to it or not, but that's pretty cool. So keep spreading the word about the show. And, of course, you can make a PayPal donation on thesolemonster.com. You can subscribe to Audible for a free 30-day trial and a free audio book that you get to keep no matter what, whether you stick with it or not. But if you do it, make sure you use our URL, audibletrial.com/solemonster. It helps out the show a great deal. And buy a shirt, prowrestlingtees.com/solemonstersoundsoff. We've got nearly 20 different shirts up there right now, up to 5XL in size for all of the shirts. They ship all over the world, so definitely give that a look as well. We will be back next weekend with a brand new podcast. That'll be episode number 379. So until then, I say be well, stay safe, have yourselves a great week, and we will see you back here next weekend to talk more wrestling on the Sound Off. Until then, take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solemonster Sounds Off.
Whatever happened to real men on this show? Can you imagine, in any other era of WWE, dressing down your top star the way that Stephanie McMahon did to John Cena on Monday night? They've done this with Cena, they've done this with Bryan, they've done it with Dolph, they've done it with Ryback, they did it with Rollins. Remember the infamous episode where Big Show was on his knees in the middle of the ring crying for his job? Tears are just streaming down this guy's face. This guy's 7 feet tall, 450 pounds, he's in the ring crying. He's a giant. Yeah, he's a giant pussy.
Solemonster Sounds Off.
Since 2007, the Solemonster Sounds Off. Available at thesolemonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solemonster Sound Off.